You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
The history of polio is very dark. It's very strange. And it really began the beginning of the vaccine religion in the United States, as far as I'm concerned. Because once the public supported the polio campaign, all vaccines kind of followed.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys and Roman Bistrionic. Today's show, Dissolving Illusions, Vaccination, Past and Present. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys and Roman Bistrionic are co-authors of Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys is a medical doctor, internist, and board-certified nephrologist currently in private practice. Roman Bistrionic is a medical researcher and author. Currently, the California legislature is fast-tracking two vaccine Senate bills. SB 277 will eliminate the personal belief and religious exemptions from vaccinations required for children to attend public and private school. SB 792 will require CDC-prescribed adult immunization of child care workers, with the exception of flu vaccine. Today we review some of the history of disease and vaccination covered in Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, thank you for joining me again.
Thank you for having me back, Bonnie.
And Roman Bistrionic, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
You are co-authors of the book Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. How did the two of you come together to write this, shall we call it, History of Disease and the Practice of Vaccination? Dr. Humphreys, let's start with you.
Well, I think it all started when Roman heard me on Gary Null's show when I was floundering in my very early months trying to talk about polio, because early on I realized that polio and smallpox were the two things that were tossed at me whenever somebody had a doubt about what I was saying about flu shots to my sick patients. So I went deep into polio thinking polio is still in the consciousness of people today. So let me go with polio. And to me, smallpox was really interesting, but it was so long ago. So I really focused on polio, and Roman, meanwhile, had been focusing on smallpox. So he heard me on Gary Null talking about polio, and he said, that's the person that I need to write my book with. And Roman had already been in the library for about 15 years, I think. And he called my office a few times, and on the third call, I think I called him back. And,
yeah, that's about right.
Yes, and it turned out that he was a real, you know, solid person who really had written an interesting book. And so we met, and it all stemmed from there.
And so how about you, Roman?
I had started a number of years earlier, and, I had heard Suzanne on the radio, and she had been talking about vaccines, and at the end she was talking a little bit about smallpox, and I was like, that's the person I need here. And we got together and wrote the book together. I had written some chapters, but we really wrote the book together.
It is a common belief that vaccination is what saved us from the infective scourges of the past. Is this claim a myth? For instance, what societal forces or improvements came together to create a healthier environment? And how significant were these improvements? You have included eyewitness descriptions in your book of horrifying living conditions in the past. How bad was it, really?
This is how I got really kind of interested in the whole subject. I had put together some data and created some graphs showing that the mortality rate for these infectious diseases had declined tremendously, in some cases 99-100%, before the vaccine was introduced, and in some cases no vaccine introduced, which led to the question is what caused that massive mortality decline. And what I found out reading literature from the 1800s was the hygienic conditions in the 1800s and the nutritional status was horrifying. People had really nothing to eat, except whatever was carted into the cities, and it was diseased food. They really didn't eat any fruits or vegetables. There was no sanitation, so people just went to the bathroom and went out into the streets. And the same thing with animals. Animals would come into the city, and they would defecate in the streets, and that would all go into the drinking supply. There was no plumbing, so the only thing you drank from was the streams and rivers, and that's what you drank. People worked horrendous hours, 12, 14, 16 hours a day. Even children were forced to work in factories, even as young as 5 years old. So you had these conditions where people were overly stressed and horrible hygienic conditions, poor nutrition, and the result was they were susceptible to all sorts of diseases, everything from consumption to scarlet fever, whooping cough, measles, you know, all these things, because they were just completely overwhelmed. But that all began to change really starting in the mid-1800s. People saw that things could change hygienically, started washing their hands. This took, of course, decades. Plumbing started coming in. Later on, electricity. So then you could have your first ice boxes and eventually refrigeration. People started getting access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And all these things came together, and that's what really caused really the decline in all these deaths from these diseases. And really just one of the greatest health revolutions in human history, I think.
Well, I also noticed in your book that starvation was rampant around the world at different times. I was absolutely amazed at all the starving people.
Sure. It wasn't just the potato famine. You know, periodically people were starving because, you know, you had to ship food around. They didn't have the infrastructure we have today. And so, you know, conditions were bad. And even if they had food, it was usually very substandard. It was generally diseased, unless you worked on, you know, you lived on a farm. But in the cities, you just got whatever you got. And, you know, things could be hanging up in the window. And, you know, there was no screens, so flies would land on that. And it just, it's even hard to even imagine how horrible it was. So basically, it was the third world conditions as far as the working class and the middle class were concerned. If you were wealthy, then you were pretty well off. But aside from that, you didn't do too well.
Dr. Humphreys, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I think that's a pretty good summary of the beginning of our book and what the conditions were and what the susceptibility was, really. I would just like to add that a lot of people misinterpret what we've said in the book, and mostly the graphs that Roman put together are looking at death rates. Okay, so people were having the same diseases that we can have today, but they were dying at a much higher rate because the people were different, not because the disease was any different. But there were some diseases that the diseases actually did decline, like typhoid fever, and there was, you know, scarlet fever, like Roman mentioned. But most of the common diseases, like pertussis, whooping cough, measles, things like that, the incidence really didn't change at all. It was the death rate that changed markedly as the humans, the immune systems and, you know, the constitutions of the humans in these cities changed because of how the environment changed.
There are two diseases that are always used when defending vaccine effectiveness and how many people vaccines have saved. Smallpox is the first one that comes to mind, which we don't hear much about today, but polio continues to be an issue in many third world countries. That is, if we are to believe media accounts. Roman Bistrionic, what did you discover in your research for your book Dissolving Illusions about the history of smallpox, its eradication, and the part played by the smallpox vaccination?
It's a long history. It began really in the 1700s. Before they even had vaccines, they were exposing people to smallpox. And the idea was to expose you to smallpox in a controlled setting. So you would get it and you would get through it because you were healthier at that time, as opposed to getting smallpox when you were unexpectedly getting the disease. And so that kind of procedure called variolation was done before the introduction of what we call vaccination. And it was somewhat successful, but unfortunately it was also spreading diseases particularly smallpox, because you can imagine if you're scratching smallpox onto somebody's arm, they're going to be a vector of disease. So people were looking for something that was perhaps a little bit better. And early on, 1798, Edward Jenner came up with this idea of taking matter from a cow, ulcers from a cow, and scratching it onto arms of people and thinking that would protect them. And that's where we get the term vaccination from, vodka for cow. Almost immediately when he came up with this idea, he claimed lifelong protection. And a lot of people jumped onto that bandwagon and said, oh, this is a great idea. Other groups of people said, this is basically quackery. This doesn't work. And really, the year he came out with that list, within a couple of years, it became vaccinationist and anti-vaccinationist right out of the gate. And it was pretty much a brutal battle up until today. In the beginning, it was kind of dicey whether it's going to go forward or not, but there was enough people supporting it, and eventually they put in laws in place in the mid-1800s to force vaccination for the entire population. And even though they had almost 100% vaccination rate because of these compulsory vaccination laws, they still had outbreaks of smallpox. So it didn't really stop anything there. They still pretty much had the same rates of outbreaks of smallpox and death. Up until around 1872, when there was really a pandemic of smallpox, and it killed scores of people. After 1872, people became rather disenchanted with the vaccination, because people were being killed by the vaccine, killed and injured, and they saw that it really wasn't working. So by 1885, in a town called Leicester, England, they protested against it, and they said, we're not going to do this anymore. And they elected a council, a government, that said, okay, well, we're not going to force compulsory vaccination. And their vaccination rates went down to around 10%. The medical professionals at that time said, hey, this is a bad idea. You're all going to suffer for your foolishness. But they never did. They continued not vaccinating and instead went for hygiene, sanitation, and isolation. And they were very successful. And they never had a recurrence of massive deaths of smallpox. So, you know, that one example showed that the vaccination wasn't really important at all in taming smallpox.
Now, in those early days, were they really vaccinating against smallpox, or did they have it mixed up with cowpox?
Well, it gets really kind of confusing. It's hard to tell exactly what they were scratching onto arms of people. Sometimes it may have been this cowpox. Sometimes what they would do is they would expose cows to smallpox, thinking that that somehow changed it into cowpox. And they would also expose it to all sorts of other things. And back at that time, they were also basically scratching from arm to arm. So you're mixing all sorts of contaminants over and over again from person to person. So they were being subjected to things that was slightly different all the time. In some cases, they were being scraped with something called the grease, which is what actually Edward Jenner thought prevented smallpox. It's ulcers on the horse's leg. And so some people got that as well. So it's all kind of mixed in depending on what time frame and who was doing it.
We all have horrible pictures in our minds of smallpox. How horrible was this disease, and did its ravages vary significantly from person to person?
Well, it was a horrible disease, but then again, all the diseases back in the 1800s were horrible. You had scarlet fever, which was a much bigger killer than smallpox or whooping cough or measles. It was called the Fell Destroyer, had a high incidence of mortality. And so, you know, all these diseases were horrible back then. But there's entries in the medical literature back in the 1800s of people being exposed to smallpox, and then they recovered fine, and they were declared to be healthier afterwards. And so I found that to be very interesting. Something similar is talked about with measles. Measles is a big killer in the 1800s, and by the 1960s, it was considered, you know, pretty much a mild disease.
I'm speaking with nephrologist Dr. Suzanne Humphreys and researcher Roman Bistrionic. Today's show, Dissolving Illusions, Vaccination, Past and Present. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. So then would you say that the health of the person who was infected would have an effect on how bad they were affected by the disease?
Oh, almost certainly. I mean, that's really how this variolation worked. If somebody was healthy and they were helped through their case of smallpox, they did quite well. A Dr. Squirrel, and I think it was 1801, wrote about the chances of dying from variolation, which is basically exposing somebody to smallpox. It was like basically 1 in 1,000, according to his estimates. It was pretty rare by that point. So you have to imagine that if the person was healthy, they did much better. And we can also see by the end of the 1800s, late 1800s into the early 1900s, smallpox was being written about as being a mild disease. It was having a much lower mortality rate. Traditionally, it was 20 or 30% mortality rate. And by the late 1800s, early 1900s, had fallen dramatically to the point where people were confusing smallpox with, like, chickenpox. It was very mild.
Could I interject on something that happened in Yugoslavia in 1972?
Yes, I was just going to ask you, Dr. Humphreys, if you wanted to weigh in on this.
Yes, I would, because smallpox, you know, it is, I believe that smallpox was a rather virulent disease. And yes, part of the picture was the health of humanity. But the other part of the picture was that the vaccine just was really ineffective. And that fact played out in Yugoslavia in 1972, where at that time, we wrote about this in the book, but there was a Yugoslavian Haji pilgrim who was vaccinated in December of 1971 at a public health clinic, and then he went to Iraq on a pilgrimage, and he contracted smallpox and brought it back to Yugoslavia. So here we have somebody who should be freshly immune. He goes and picks up smallpox. He brings it back to Yugoslavia, which was a highly vaccinated population, highly compliant with smallpox vaccination. And there were 175 cases and 35 deaths. You know, so that's a pretty high death rate there. But what was interesting is that the World Health Organization's own report said that in the age group of 20 and over, that 92 patients had previously been vaccinated, while only 21 were unvaccinated. And they quoted that the relatively large number of previously vaccinated cases among those over 7 years of age indicates a decrease in post-vaccinal immunity following primary vaccination, as well as a lack of successful revaccination when they were 7 and 14 years old. So if we were to keep going with smallpox, it would be like every other vaccine, where we would be told that we need to keep having it every 5 to 10 years in order to maintain our immunity, because not only did the vaccine failed immediately, but long term it was nothing like what they had thought it was in the past. And how did they get this epidemic was put under control by the same way that the problems in Leicester, England, and in the old days was put under control. And that was with isolation. You know, you take a person, you take them out of the population, you sanitize everything in their house. People that are already immune deal with them. And that's how they put out the fire in Yugoslavia. But just to save face for the vaccination, they went ahead and they vaccinated the entire population again, even though they knew that the vaccine was ineffective.
So then smallpox is still around, it sounds like, if this was in the 70s.
Well, it's very interesting. You know, this is one reason why I kind of stuck more to polio than smallpox. Roman really had the courage to go to smallpox, because I just think there's really not enough good information. But I can tell you that if you Google image monkeypox, you'll be surprised at what you will see on your image. It will look exactly like smallpox. And I can also tell you that back in the days before polymerase chain reaction and these sophisticated biological techniques that we use today to distinguish chickenpox from monkeypox, from goatpox and everything else pox, you know, looking at the genetic sequences, they weren't able to do that back then. So how many cases were called smallpox that weren't smallpox? I have no idea. But we do know that it did seem to become, there was a change in the characteristic of the disease. But we also know that they put all kinds of things in this vaccine to the point where it was no longer cowpox or humanpox. It was some sort of a laboratory-produced hybrid that even today, and again, this is in our smallpox chapter, and you know, there's a lot of information in this book, and I'll admit that I don't remember every little detail, but I remember writing about what the genetic sequencing showed the origins of today's vaccine actually are. And it's pretty crazy. And then to think that this is going to immunize us and protect us against, quote, smallpox, you know, your guess is as good as mine where smallpox really went. But there's a lot of information that shows that the vaccine did not do what it was hoped to do. And what the, you know, World Health Organization and all the powers that be at the time were saying that it did do.
Dr. Humphreys, could you describe what you found out about the eradication of polio and what part polio vaccination played in the history of this disease?
Well, yes, I can. And I think the best thing for me to do is to just let everybody know that what I'm going to do is a very brief synopsis of the bigger story, which really could be an encyclopedia. I also did a 90-minute video called Smoke, Mirrors, and the Disappearance of Polio that's available on YouTube where people can go and listen to the fuller picture. But when I started my investigation into polio, I knew nothing. I knew what every other doctor knows, which is that polio was eradicated, that Jonas Salk created one vaccine and Albert Sabin created the other, and that we no longer have it in America thanks to those vaccines. Well, what I found out was that poliomyelitis is a term that really just means inflammation of the gray matter of the spinal cord, which is just one area inside the spinal cord. And it doesn't really indicate what caused it. Now, there is a such thing as a poliovirus. And I was really surprised when I went to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website and found out that if we infected 100 people with poliovirus, that 95% of them would be completely asymptomatic, and that approximately 4% of them would maybe have some minor symptoms and a stiff neck, and that there might be some paralysis in less than 1%, and that the majority of that 1%, that their paralysis would recover within 60 days. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. So polio actually isn't the, you know, killer virus that we all thought it was, especially when we look at these pictures of these poor kids in the iron lungs and in their casts. And then I learned more about this organization called the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis and the March of Dimes. And I found out that, you know, those nice little jars that you see at the countertop when you're shopping for the March of Dimes, it really doesn't stem from what I believe is a benevolent mindset. The history of polio is very dark. It's very strange. And it really began the beginning of the vaccine religion in the United States, as far as I'm concerned, because once the public supported the polio campaign, all vaccines kind of followed. And people now think, oh, wow, you know, you think of the polio vaccine. Even if you're anti-vaccination, you still want to give your kid the polio vaccine because you don't want them to get polio. And that's one of the reasons I went so deep into polio, because it was one of the vaccines that people still held on to. And I thought, well, let me see what really went on there with polio. And it turned out that poliomyelitis, actually, we know today, and this is not, you know, fringe quack, you know, out there kind of thinking. This is conventional medical literature supports the truth that there were many underlying causes of poliomyelitis, and it was actually the minority that were caused by a poliovirus. And there are some people in the anti-vaccination campaign who criticize me very heavily and say that actually there's no such thing as a poliovirus at all. Suzanne Humphreys, it is a toxin and your body is just trying to get rid of something. That I really don't believe. I've spent years now going through the virology and going through the genetics and the genetic code of what these viruses were and how they typed them. And there's no way that I believe that's true. But I can tell you that there's still some discord within people that are doubtful about vaccination, and there are people that disagree with me and are actually even more radical than I am and will say that there's actually no such thing as the polio virus. Well, I don't believe that's true. I believe there's a such thing as a polio virus. I believe viruses are ubiquitous. They're all over the place. There are probably 1,000 different species populating your colon at any one time of different kinds of viruses. They're part of the microbiome, and they live benevolently, I should say, or they live harmlessly inside of us. And the polio virus is proof that these viruses can actually live harmlessly inside of us. So once again, the question has to be, what's wrong with the person that they couldn't tolerate having this virus come into them without becoming paralyzed? And the answers I got when I put all the pieces together were that there were toxins in the environment. There were chemicals in the environment. There was DDT, which was basically sprinkled on sandwiches. I mean, it was sprayed on children at school. There are videos today of these events that happened in the 1950s. Military was sprayed up, down, and sideways in their pants, in their head, in their hats. And then they were sent off to battle. And we describe this in about a 70-page polio chapter in our book. And even if you just look at arsenic, I mean, the story of arsenic is just so crazy. I mean, there was a drug called triparsamide in 1939 marketed by Merck through Rockefeller. And they were giving up to 100 injections of arsenic to people who had syphilis. And they were rubbing mercurials on their skin. They were smoking arsenic. You know, these toxins were just everywhere. And so these toxins alone, if you look at the pharmacology and the toxicology, you find that these toxins are capable of causing all the same symptoms as poliomyelitis, including the same histological changes in the spinal cord that poliovirus can cause. My take on it is that these chemicals trashed the bowel microbiome, and we know that they're very toxic to the bowel. If you have arsenic poisoning, I've witnessed, it was actually a church poisoning up in Maine when I was on call, and there were upwards of 20 people that came in after just a tiny bit of arsenic was swallowed in the coffee. These people were so violently sick. They were vomiting. They were having massive diarrhea. You know, the gastrointestinal system is very much disrupted by these toxins, as well as DDT. So when that happens, an otherwise benign enterovirus has the ability to get into your nervous system, get into your body, into your bloodstream and your nervous system, and to wreak havoc. And that's really what I believe, how this all kind of fits together. And so we had this, you know, media hype in the 1950s that there was this terrible virus going around paralyzing people. And even stranger to me was that there was an event in 1916, where there was an escape virus out of the Rockefeller labs in New York City, and the mortality rate from that escape virus was 25%. Well, you know, that set the stage for America to really embrace this anti-polio campaign and to support the March of Dimes, donating dimes, which added up to millions and millions of dollars to get this vaccine on track. The scientists that disagreed with how it was done were fired, and that's also very well documented in our book. So eventually they had a very agreeable scientific group who got together and produced this vaccine, which the first year that it was out, we know, was a disaster. It paralyzed hundreds of people, and those are just the ones that were accepted and reported by the public health department.
I'm speaking with nephrologist Dr. Suzanne Humphreys and researcher Roman Bistrionic. Today's show, Dissolving Illusions, Vaccination, Past and Present. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So the story of polio, you know, I could really just go on and on and on, but let me just fast forward now till we have the vaccine. And all of a sudden they decided that the numbers weren't working out as well as they should have been. So they changed the diagnostic criteria of polio, and they changed it so that in 1955, the year that the mass vaccination initiation, two exams of any one patient 60 days apart had to show paralysis, where in the past you only had to have two exams within 24 hours. So what they did, because paralysis had actually increased 50% from 1957 to 1958 and 80% from 1958 to 1959. These new definitions help to hide the fact that in the era of vaccination, they were seeing actually more paralysis. So they redefined polio. And in that redefining, they were basically reporting a new disease, which was paralytic poliomyelitis with a longer lasting paralysis. And so the decline in polio diagnosis would have happened whether they had a vaccine or not, because they changed how they labeled something polio and who could actually call it polio. They also redefined what a polio epidemic was. It used to be that 20 out of 100,000 in the population was considered an epidemic, but they moved that up to 35 in 100,000 per year after the Salk vaccine was released. So between that and changing the length of paralysis from 24 hours to 60 days, and also any polio that occurred within 30 days of vaccination was not logged as vaccine-induced, but as pre-existing poliomyelitis. So this ignored the vaccine failures and vaccine-induced cases. So all of these manipulations eliminated a large portion of what was probably non-paralytic polio. So that's just another part of the story that's really interesting. And then if we go to 1958, there was a big polio epidemic in Michigan. And somebody decided to let's see which of these cases that were labeled as poliomyelitis because they had paralysis and all the other symptoms actually manifested poliovirus either in their stool or in their blood. And what they found is they got 869 stool specimens, and they found there was no virus in 401 of them. There was poliovirus in 292, and there were other viruses in the rest. Really interesting, isn't it? I mean, basically just slightly over one quarter of all these cases actually had poliovirus. Then they looked at antibody changes in blood tests. And if you're infected with polio in the bloodstream, you should see a rise in certain antibodies. So they looked at 191 of these patients, and they found there was no antibody change in 123 of them, that there was evidence of poliovirus in 48 of them, and other viruses in the rest. So again, only around one quarter of these people actually had poliovirus. So to summarize, we had problems with the diagnosis. We had problems that there were other things that were causing polio. And we had problems with relabeling later after the vaccine came out in order to elevate and support a vaccine that was actually causing more paralysis in that year than the wild virus caused.
So then, are there other types of paralysis that have been classified as polio?
Oh, yes. Actually, one of the most interesting cases is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He's the most famous polio case you could probably think of, right?
Yes.
Well, according to a team of modern doctors who analyzed extensively his medical records assessing the likelihood that he had polio, I mean, these were neurologists who had access to all of his medical records, and this was published in 2003 in the Journal of Medical Biologics, they determined that the paralysis was actually Guillain-Barré syndrome and not polio at all, not poliomyelitis from a polio virus. So there is a big, long list of entities that look just like polio, and that once you rule out a polio virus, you could call it these other things like Coxsackie virus, echovirus, vaccine-associated, cytomegalovirus, varicella-zoster virus, Guillain-Barré syndrome, transverse myelitis, which we have hundreds of cases per year of infants on what today would be iron lungs, but they're called ventilators, exotoxin from diphtheria, botulism. You know, there are all kinds of other things now that we're starting to distinguish and do testing that we find, and we're not finding poliovirus per se.
And what is Guillain-Barré?
Oh, that is, it's a syndrome whereby there's paralysis that progresses over a period of time. It's been associated with vaccination. It's been associated with certain viral infections. And basically, the medical community really doesn't understand it very well and doesn't really have great ways to treat it.
Do you know whether or not Franklin Roosevelt was ever vaccinated against polio?
No, he wasn't, because his disease occurred much longer before the vaccine was available. But what we do know about him is that the day that he became paralyzed, he was swimming up off the coast of between Canada and Maine in water that was upstream. I believe it was from a tannery, and they had just dumped some chemicals into the water. And the other thing with Franklin Delano Roosevelt is that he was treated the way the children who developed the problems with the one short leg and one long leg, he was immobilized. He was put into a cast and immobilized for a long period of time. And we now know today that that's actually the worst thing you can do to somebody who has acute flaccid paralysis, especially from a viral infection, and that just the immobilization itself makes any potential neurologic degeneration worse. In fact, if I were to take a healthy person's leg and immobilize it the way they did with poliovirus, especially a growing child, you're certainly going to have deformities later on. They were doing barbaric treatments that were reported by medical physicians of the time, like tendon transplantation and electric treatments, and they were really trying anything, and they were ignoring the one person who was having the most success at treating the paralysis, and that was a lady, a nurse named Elizabeth Kenny. And I talk a lot about her in the video, and we wrote a lot about her in the book. And Elizabeth Kenny was actually really despised by the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, and they pretended to support her, where in the meantime they were really trying to undermine her, because if her techniques were adopted and poliomyelitis was reversible as readily as she was showing it could be, then where would this vaccine campaign be? And that might sound like a crazy conspiracy theory, but you can go ahead and read the history books yourself. You can read her autobiography. You can read about what doctors in Minnesota were saying about her and doctors all around the world, how they were comparing what she was able to do to what the orthopedic surgeons could do. And they first allowed her only to treat the leftovers that the orthopedic surgeons had already messed up really badly, and they had pretty much given up on. She would actually bring a lot of these kids back to some semblance of functionality. And then she was finally able to treat freshly diagnosed poliomyelitis. And she was actually able to keep people out of iron lungs. And so her technique was actually very highly successful. And it's really a shame that it's been forgotten. And when you mention the third world today, what you will see is where this vaccine is being promoted, how they're treating poliomyelitis today is just the wrong way that they were treating it in the old days. They're not using Sister Elizabeth Kenny's methods. They're using the methods that didn't work before, which is immobilization and casting of these contracted limbs.
Well, what was her technique?
It was a combination. She never immobilized that way. Her analysis was completely different from what the orthopedics analysis was. They were basically saying that everything was paralyzed, and she was saying no, there was a real problem with spasm. I mean, you know how you have opposing muscles, say take your arm, you know, you have your bicep, which you can do a curl with, and then there are muscles on the other side which pull your arm down again. Well, she was saying that there one set of those muscles was in spasm, and it wasn't a problem of paralysis, it was a problem of spasm. And so she was treating with hot woolen packs, and in that treatment she was not only taking care of a lot of the pain in these kids, but the spasm was going down. And she was also very much into nutrition, which is really important when treating poliomyelitis. And then afterwards, she was probably one of the very early physical therapists. The woman was a genius. I mean, reading her story, she first rehabilitated her brother when he was a little weakling, and he became one of the strongest men in the Army. But she was an inventor, and she had a very good mechanical mind. And so she also developed techniques to basically re-educate the brain-muscle connection after this problem happened, so that kids that were lying there thinking they couldn't move their muscles, it was actually because there was some sort of a disconnect that happened between the brain and the muscle. And she basically started doing physical therapy, and it was very successful. She got a lot of people back on their feet 100% that the orthopedic surgeons would have completely had them be cripples for the rest of their lives.
Well, that's very interesting. Is it possible for a person to have the poliovirus and no paralysis? And if so, how do you account for this?
Well, yes. I mean, those would be the 95% that the CDC has on their website. And interestingly enough, they used to have this data, and I went back on their website about a year ago, and I found that they've actually changed it. They don't have that same data on there right now. But I PDF'd it, and I have screenshots of how the CDC defined it just the way I told you. So the majority of people that get infected with poliomyelitis never even know it, just like the majority of viruses that are in your body right now that are not making you sick. It's because, once again, it's not so much about the virus as it is about the susceptibility and the ability to have entrance of this problem into your body, because the commensals that should be out competing these other viruses are unhealthy, and because the leakiness of the gut is really high.
Is there evidence that childhood diseases such as measles, mumps, and chickenpox serve a useful purpose? Are vaccines suppressing a natural process in children that is actually there for a reason? What do you think about that, Roman?
Well, if you read the literature from the medical literature from the 1950s, they talk about how mothers noted that people who went through measles were stronger and healthier after their bout of measles. So there is evidence of, you know, and there's people that, you know, talk about that, that it did perform some type of function. Now, if you were malnourished, if you were low on vitamin A, vitamin C, and you were hit with measles, then you were in deep trouble. But I think that if you were healthy, you went through measles, you were ended up healthier on the other side, and then you had lifelong immunity.
Dr. Humphreys, what do you think about the idea that childhood diseases such as measles, mumps, and chickenpox may in fact serve a useful purpose?
Well, what I know is that the measles infection does have a profound effect upon the immune system. It's very complicated and it's actually very poorly understood. One of the things we wrote about in the book, as Roman alluded to, were cases that were written up in the medical literature of people who, say, had kidney disease where they were losing massive amounts of protein in their urine. And after they developed a case of measles, everybody thought, oh, they're definitely going to die now. We thought they were going to die because they had this disease, but now they've got measles. So they would buy their funeral suits, and lo and behold, the kid would improve and get better. And so we've seen that happen, and we've also seen tumors melt away after measles infection. So measles is actually a treatment that scientists are working on, high-dose measles therapy for people who have certain tumors, because we know that it has an effect upon the immune system. But that effect is dependent upon the nutritional status of the person. So if you take measles and infect somebody who has very poor innate immunity or cell-mediated immunity, which is dependent upon certain vitamins like vitamin A and vitamin C and certain minerals, then they're going to be devastated by measles. And I would not say that those people are going to have an improvement in their life. They're more likely to be dead. So I can't say that serves a useful purpose to those people. If you have people who have a healthy cell-mediated immunity, then those people generally get through it. And what happens with measles is that it's basically like a molting process that happens in many organs of the body, you know, the liver, the intestines, the skin, the kidneys. Any of your cells that get infected with measles are basically annihilated and killed off by your immune system, and some of your immune cells are also killed off. So there's lots of medical literature that says that with a healthy cell-mediated immunity, not only are you much easier able to tolerate the vaccine, but you're also much more likely to deal with the infection gracefully and recover without significant sequelae, and then, as Roman said, have approximately 75 years of immunity, as we know from an isolated event that happened on some islands called the Faroe Islands.
I'm speaking with nephrologist Dr. Suzanne Humphreys and researcher Roman Bistrionic. Today's show, Dissolving Illusions, Vaccination, Past and Present. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Do I think chickenpox and mumps serve a purpose? I don't really know. I've never found evidence that either of those diseases serve a useful purpose. You know, the only thing about chickenpox is that, you know, if you do have chickenpox, then you're later susceptible to having shingles. So a lot of parents ask me, should I take my kid to a chickenpox party because I want them to have it when they're young? And, you know, it's a really hard thing to answer, because if you can go your whole life without having chickenpox at all, then that means you can go your whole life without having shingles if you become immunocompromised for some reason later. I don't really believe chickenpox serves a useful purpose, but I believe that it was an endemic virus that was better to catch at a certain age than it was, you know, older ages. But the hype about getting chickenpox as an adult, you know, it's really not borne out in what I have noticed clinically.
What's an exanthem?
An exanthem basically means it's a widespread rash that occurs in children, and it can be caused by toxins, by drugs, and by different microorganisms, and actually it can be caused by even autoimmune diseases. So it just basically means it's a certain kind of rash, and they're very common in childhood, and they're associated with many different skin infections like enteroviruses, chickenpox, measles, German measles, things like that.
Is it possible that vaccination may itself be causing disease? Have you found evidence that this possibility is real but very little understood?
Well, you know, that's really what started my quest here. Before 2009, I was vaccinating my patients. You know, I had accepted vaccines before medical school, never suspecting anything. And it wasn't until I started to see disease myself. And Roman can tell you about his own children and what happened after they were vaccinated. But all you have to do is go look at the vaccine adverse event reporting system. Look at the package inserts, which report what diseases are potential. The patient reports, the letters that I get every day from parents, you know, are very sad. Look at what honest doctors are willing to say. Look at what the Supreme Court said during the recent trial when they said that vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. You know, they're basically saying, look, you know, we can't guarantee 100% safety here. Look at what Dr. James Shannon of the NIH said back in the 1950s during one of the Senate hearings. And he wasn't being sarcastic. He was just stating a fact. And he said, the only safe vaccine is the one never given. Because you don't know who's going to have an adverse event after a vaccine. And there's no such thing as 100% safe vaccine. Look at what doctors Jonas and Daryl Salk said in March 4th, 1977, which Roman and I put in the book as a quote. But they said that live virus vaccines against paralytic poliomyelitis, for example, may in each instance produce the disease it's intended to prevent. The live virus vaccines against measles and mumps may produce such side effects as encephalitis. Both of these problems are due to the inherent difficulty of controlling live viruses once they are placed in a live person. And that's really the crux of the matter, is that because we're all different, because our nutritional status is all different, because our vaccination status and drugs that we're taking, how we were born, whether we were breastfed or not, we're all different. Genetically, we're actually slightly different from each other. And so because of that, we are not a uniform population. And so one-size-fits-all vaccination program doesn't make any sense to say that everything's going to be just fine after we inject all of you with this same, very same vaccine, because of just what the Dr. Salk said, is that we don't know what happens after it's put into each person, because the vaccinomics and the vaccinologists today and the vaccinogenomics and all these new branches of medicine that are evolving are basically about that, that we're all so different that we genetically respond differently to different vaccines.
Roman, in your book, Dissolving Illusions, you include 50 graphs that present a view of the history of disease from the 1800s into the 1900s. What do these graphs illustrate?
Just as a note, they're all available on dissolvingillusions.com, the full-color graphs. So anybody can go look at those anytime they want. They show a lot of different things. A lot of them are the mortality declines. And again, that's what really got me going into this project in the first place. You can see the mortality declines for scarlet fever, whooping cough, measles, all these different diseases declining in England and various states in the United States. And it just, no matter where I looked, it always showed the same thing. From the 1800s into the 1900s, measles, these various diseases all just plummeted in mortality rate. There's a whole bunch of different types of graphs in there showing that type of information, and even various incidence graphs in there as well.
So what are you saying, that these diseases were in a steep decline before the practice of vaccination was introduced?
Well, certainly that, and then in some cases, like scarlet fever, for example, declined without any type of vaccine and any kind of widespread use. So, yeah, all these things went down quite a bit. For example, measles in England, the mortality rate declined by almost 100% before the vaccine was even introduced. Now, the incidence rate, that's a little different. There was a decline in incidence, but after the vaccine for measles, there was a decline in the incidence, and that's why we don't see measles today.
Well, right, and we were talking earlier, you were making the distinction between the mortality rate and the morbidity rate. I mean, were there records of how many people would actually come down with these diseases or not?
Well, there were more in the 1900s. I'm not aware of anything in the 1800s. They more kept track of the mortality rates. The incidence rates, they started keeping track in sometime during the 1900s. And so we have, you know, that data and those graphs in the book as well.
Since a lot of these vaccines are relatively new, that is, they have been introduced in the last 2 or 3 or 4 decades, does it still remain to be seen if when these vaccines wear off, assuming they do in certain people, that elderly people would suddenly start coming down with some of these diseases that they've been vaccinated against? I mean, I guess we don't really have the whole picture on that yet, do we?
Oh, we've got plenty of information on that. And even if you just look at what happened in California recently, you know, back in the old days before vaccines, what we had was a situation where babies almost never got infected with measles. And children between the age of 2 and 15, about 95 to 97% of them developed measles by the time they were 15. And adults never got measles. And once you developed the disease, you had lifelong immunity. So you were really protecting the herd better than somebody today who's been vaccinated. And the reason is today those immune people, like my grandmother, have died off, and my mother and father have died off. So the people that were really had solid immunity from the natural disease are gone. And so what we're left with now is a vaccinated population. And what's happened is that we've taken measles successfully away from the population that handles it the most graceful, and that is the toddlers and the older kids. And now we're seeing cases in young babies when measles comes to town, and we're seeing cases in older adults. And the case in California, there was an enormous amount of cases in the older adults.
Now, you did say that before vaccinations, no adults got measles. But, I mean, occasionally an adult would, wouldn't they?
It was very rare. It would be extremely rare because if you look at the scientists that wrote about herd immunity, Hedrick wrote about it. If 95 to 97% of your population has had the disease by the time they're 15, then you might have some younger adults developing measles. And we did see it happen sometimes in the military that where they were, you know, younger adults, 18 and 20. And those were probably people that were living out away from one of the more populated areas. And then they were later exposed and would develop it. So there were some adults that were developing measles, but nothing like today. When we look at the age distribution in California of our outbreak, 56% of those cases were over 20 years old. I mean, in the old days, it wouldn't have been more than 5%. And if you look at the less than 1 year olds, 11% of those cases in California were less than 1 year old. That would have been less than 1% back before the vaccine, because mothers who have the natural disease maintain a level of solid immunity that they are able to pass to the baby through the placenta and in part through their milk. Vaccinated mothers don't, and that's also well established in many, many medical articles, conventional medical articles in the medical literature.
Now, the reason I ask you about that, Suzanne, is that when I was young, there was a girl that lived near us who was deaf, and the story was that her mother had caught the measles when she was pregnant with this girl. Have you heard of that?
Yes, that certainly can happen. You know, the thing is, there's no guarantee whether vaccines are here or whether they're not. What we have to look at is what is the higher risk. So there's always going to be deaths from diseases, and there's always going to be death after vaccination. And there will be mothers who will contract diseases when they're pregnant. That's really not ideal. You don't want to have very young babies contracting measles, and you don't want to have pregnant mothers contracting measles. And the reason is that pregnant mothers are immunosuppressed. Their cell-mediated immunity is intentionally clamped down in order to tolerate that baby inside of them that is genetically different. It's basically like tolerating a transplant to some degree. Also because it has some of the father's genetic material as well. So it would otherwise be seen as foreign if that cell-mediated immunity was normal. So mother's immune systems are unable to deal with measles very well, and then it gets in and causes problems in the fetus. And depending on what trimester, it can be much worse. So you're going to hear of cases in the old days of people who, you know, but it'd be very, very rare because, as I said, most people had the disease by the time they were 15. But you also have to remember that it wasn't uncommon to be pregnant when you were 13 back then.
What is herd immunity, and is it a valid concept?
Yes, herd immunity is a valid concept. It's just a reality, actually. What the term means is that if most of the people in the population have immunity, that the people around them that don't have immunity will be essentially blocked from a disease because it'll be interrupted by the people that do have immunity. And that's why it's called herd immunity. And Dr. Hedrick, I believe it was in the 1920s, is the one who first looked at this, looking at measles in Baltimore, Maryland. What he found was that when the amount of susceptibles in the childhood population reached around 45%, that epidemics occurred. And then there would be a short wave of measles, and then it would stop until the susceptibles dropped to around 35%. But in no time was he describing that there was 95% immunity in the childhood population. He was describing a much lower level of immunity that was interrupting transmission. And that's what herd immunity meant when it was first coined, and it was directed at the natural disease. And then vaccination came along. And in the beginning with measles, they said, well, we just have to vaccinate a small part of the childhood population and we will eradicate this disease in 3 years. Well, guess what? That didn't happen because 1967 rolled along and there was no eradication of measles. So then they set a new goal and they increased the amount of children they said they had to vaccinate, and they still didn't reach their goal. So then they said, well, this vaccine isn't working quite as well as we thought it was, so now we need to give all the children 2 vaccines, and we need to raise the amount in the population that are getting vaccinated to 90 or 95%. And so that worked a lot better. But now today we're seeing epidemics again, and so they're saying, well, 95% isn't enough to give us herd immunity because we're still getting transmission, so now we need to go to 98 or 99%. And this is the most recent recommendation that's been put out by certain medical journals and writers in medical journals, is that we now need 99% in order to provide herd immunity.
Roman Bistrionic, thank you very much. And thank you, Dr. Oh. Suzanne Humphreys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun on.
I've been speaking with Dr. Suzanne Humphreys and Roman Bistrionic. Today's show has been Dissolving Illusions, Vaccination, Past and Present. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys and Roman Bistrionic are co-authors of Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys is a medical doctor, internist, and board-certified nephrologist, currently in private practice. Roman Bistrionic is a medical researcher and author. He has been researching the history of diseases and vaccines for more than 15 years and has an extensive background in health and nutrition. Currently, the California legislature is fast-tracking 2 vaccine Senate bills. SB 277 will eliminate the personal belief and religious exemptions from vaccines required for children to attend public and private school. SB 792 will require CDC-prescribed adult immunization of child care workers, with the exception of flu vaccine. Visit dissolvingillusions.com. That's dissolvingillusions.com. And visit drsuzanne.net. That's drsuzanne.net. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R at G-U-N-S-A-N-D-B-U-T-T-E-R.org. Visit gunsandbutter.org to sign up for our email list and receive our newsletter. Guns and Butter Online now includes a new website, an active Twitter feed, show archives, and a blog. Follow us at G&B Radio.
Hey, yo, we'll be right back. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear some more of Professor Richard Wolff's long and brilliant lecture, Capitalism Hits the Fan. Last week, Wolff explained the major causes of our present economic pickle. Various factors reduced demand for labor in the U.S. Profits rose, but wages stagnated, so workers worked longer hours and went deep into debt. The situation was unsustainable, and around 2007 it collapsed. Today we'll hear Wolff focus more on the CEOs and financiers, and how much of what they did made the situation still worse and harder to fix. Wolff shows us why there is no easy fix, but he does end today with some practical suggestions. Plus the very sensible proposal that we stop treating corporate capitalism as a given and ask ourselves, can't we do better than this? Here is Professor Richard Wolff.
What happened to the business community when it was making all this money? It got really excited. And it should have gotten excited. This was like a windfall. This was like a dream, a fantasy of business come true. So what did the business community do when they were able to get more and more productivity, more and more from each worker per hour, but they didn't have to pay them anymore? And all that money was coming in. Well, the first thing our business leaders did was to say, you know what this is about? You know why we're making all this money? Because we are really good entrepreneurs. We are spectacular managers. And what do you do for a really stunning entrepreneur and a really profitable manager? Well, you ought to pay them. Starting in the 1970s, the salaries and the bonuses that the boards of directors gave themselves went crazy. I know some of you have gotten upset in recent months as you've heard about companies that are collapsed who are paying their executives tens and twenties and thirties millions of dollars of bonuses. I understand that you're upset. You're just 30 years late. They didn't want to understand, and maybe that's why you didn't know, that the reason their profits went up was because they stopped raising wages. They preferred the explanation, we are managerial geniuses. We should be paid $20, $40, $60, $80 million a year. So they took a lot of the profit and they gave it, surprise, surprise, to themselves. At this point, I'd play the national anthem again. What else did they do? And if you understand this, you'll see much about modern American politics. They used much of the money to move even more production abroad. You know, most of the moving of production to China took place in the last 20 years when all of this was going on. It's very expensive to close a factory in Waltham, Massachusetts, and open it in Tientsin. It's disruptive, it's expensive, it's risky. They wouldn't have done it if they hadn't been flush with the money to make all these changes easily. So they used the money to move the jobs abroad, thereby deepening the whole problem. Here's a third thing they did. They said, we're going to use this money, this profit that we're earning, to reshape American politics. We're flush with money. And over the last 30 years, we are living with the political results. The mass of workers turning inward, remember the bowling alone story I told you, the mass of workers not only withdraw from bowling leagues and PTAs and trade unions, they stop participating in politics. They lost interest. Politics was no longer a neighborhood store with people with volunteers knocking on the door. Politics is about TV. The government is surrounded by armies of very expensive lobbyists. Increasingly, our politicians have to be billionaires themselves. The rich took over. I live in Manhattan. Our mayor is Michael Bloomberg. He just spent $120 million of his money to be mayor again. He outspent his Democratic rival 11 to 1. So excited were the mass of New York citizens in the mayoral election we just had a couple months ago. I should explain, New York City is an overwhelmingly Democratic city. The majority of people are Democratic registered voters. In the Democratic primary to decide who's going to run for mayor and so on, 11% of registered Democrats voted. 89% of the citizens of New York who are registered Democrats couldn't be bothered, didn't walk the three blocks to the church or the YMCA or wherever the polling place was to do it. But while the American working class was withdrawing from politics to take care of the time of work they had to do and the stresses in the family and their anxieties about debts, while they were withdrawing from politics, in was coming the profit money to reshape the politics. We didn't have a sea change of political opinion shifting to the right. None of that. Stop. We had a mass of Americans quitting, no longer interested, no longer involved. Don't give a damn. While a tiny part of our population, collecting an unprecedented amount of money, went in and made politics work for them. And that, too, comes out of the story of the wages and the profits and the relationship between them. And the last thing the business community did with its money was become hysterical. Very important that you understand that. Well, the business community went crazy. In the 1990s, they began to imagine that the stock market was a magical place and you could start a new company and you could go into something called the internet and you could promise that you'd make money in the future and you could sell stocks and people would buy them and bid against each other and make the price go up. It was really exciting. And from 1994 to 2000, the stock market went completely nuts. Everybody knows that. In the spring of 2000, the stock market collapsed when it turned out that a lot of these companies had no prospect of making profits ever, that you had spent $400 a share for a company that wasn't worth 4 cents a share. And then the stock market collapsed. And that's the actual beginning of our crisis, March and April of 2000. The most important stock market in the United States is called the NASDAQ. It's in New York City. It trades in these technological stocks. It hit a level of 5,000 at the index that measures the NASDAQ. Today, the NASDAQ is at 1,900. Do you understand? The most important stock market in the United States is today worth less than half it was in 2000. In terms of the long term, the stock market has been in a depression for a decade already. But they didn't stop. So much euphoria, so much money, that when the stock market wasn't an interesting place to play, the hysteria moved to the second place. Housing. Building. Suddenly people got completely nuts, threw huge amounts of money to build condos and co-ops and new buildings and a second house and a house with a lawn and a house with a lake. And here's an example of how crazy it got that you read about in the newspaper last week. In the middle of the desert in the Middle East, a group of real estate developers, including a number of Americans, decided to build a new city in the desert. They built new lakes, new roadways, mammoth buildings. The place is called Dubai. And on Wednesday evening of last week, the leader of Dubai, Sheikh something, I don't remember the details of the name, announced to the world that the, ready, $60 billion that had been borrowed to build this fantastic real estate development, that they couldn't make the payments, they couldn't pay the interest, they couldn't pay back the principal. And so the glittering city in the desert sits there, losing billions and billions. That happened everywhere. All over New York City, where I live, there are half-completed condos, half-completed buildings. They're not, no one works on them day after day after day. There's no point in completing these places because they can't sell them. They can't rent them. They can't do anything with them. We went crazy in our real estate. And now we've come to 2007, and what have we got? Well, we've got the results of having postponed for 30 years coming to terms with what happened to change America. The end of rising wages as a payment for people's rising productivity. The workers are exhausted. They can't work more. They can't borrow more. They can't keep up consumption. And the businesses were so extravagant, producing all over the world, building things that couldn't possibly survive. Not only did people get crazy with the investment, but they invented all kinds of new financial instruments. I don't have the time to go into it, but if you'd like, I can do that in the questioning. But I'll give you two examples. A new kind of stock was invented. This was very exciting. When was it invented? The 1970s. It's called an asset-backed security. This is a marvelous thing. You can now buy a share of stock starting in the 1970s that isn't a share of a company that makes anything. Instead, when you buy the share, you get a piece of a group of mortgages. So the Smith family that's making its monthly mortgage payment and the Brown family, they're put together in a little pot. And you, by buying a share of this stock, you get a piece of all those mortgages. You actually get a portion of the monthly payment made by, say, 5,000 families. And billions were issued, and people all over the world bought these shares. But people all over the world aren't stupid, and they worried. They worried, how can I be sure that if I buy this, that the people whose mortgage payments are what this thing is worth will keep up those payments? What happens if they can't make the monthly payment? What happens then? And the American financial industry rose to the challenge. Here's what they did. They said, we're going to issue this new security, this ABS, asset-backed security is what it's called. We're going to issue it and attach to it, staple to it, an insurance policy. And the insurance policy is going to say, if for any reason anybody who owes money on their mortgage or their car loan or anything stops paying, so the security you have can't pay you the way it is, here's an insurance company that will make good. The biggest insurance company in the world led the way with American ingenuity. It's called the AIG Corporation. Stands for American International Group. They wrote, you ready? Ready? Trillions of dollars of insurance policies guaranteeing these. So then what happened in America in 2007 when the perfectly predictable happened? Suddenly, exhausted American families, indebted beyond what they could do, began to default. They couldn't make the monthly payment on the house. They couldn't make the monthly payment on the car. They couldn't make the monthly payment on their student loans, whatever. Well, at first there was great trembling, but then people said, no, we're okay. We'll go to the insurance company and we'll say, see, they're not paying, you have to pay. That was a great moment. That took place in October of 2008. A whole bunch of New York banks arrived at the headquarters of AIG and said, make good on the insurance policy. And the leader of AIG turned to them with a big smile and said, I don't have the money, have a nice day. And at that moment, the American government suddenly was staring into the abyss. Because across America, thousands of city, state, and local governments, thousands of pension funds had invested their money buying these securities, counting on those insurance policies. All across America, the administrators of pension funds were getting ready. I worked on some of these, getting ready to write letters to pensioners, old folks, saying to them, we are sorry to inform you that because these asset-backed securities that we bought are now not worth very much and the insurance policy that goes with them cannot be paid off by the company that wrote the policy, we're going to have to reduce your monthly pension from $2,482 to $37.12. At that point, the American government understood that this was not a little crisis, this was not a temporary crisis, that, to coin a phrase, something had hit the fan, and the government had to step in. Is the program of rescuing the banks and spending all this money and borrowing from the Chinese and others, is it working? Well, I think the answer to that is a big not so well. It has helped the banks. They're looking a little better on paper than they did a year ago. But for the average person, for the mass of Americans, it hasn't gotten any better. The unemployment keeps getting worse. The foreclosures keep getting worse. The crises at the fiscal levels of the state all get worse. And indeed, more and more Americans are becoming very aware of it, that some people are getting a lot of help from the government, but I don't seem to be one of them. And the people who are around me who live in my neighborhood and work in my job, they don't seem to be among those folks either. And you're beginning to see a political separation in America that ought to scare you. Masses of Americans beginning to believe that they are being frozen out, dropped out. This is a population that is getting rageful, and for good reason. It really looks like we've saved the banks and the insurance companies, but the rest of us are on our own. So I don't think it's working. And I think that the president knows it. But think on this as a conclusion. In the depths of the Depression, when things got really bad and the American people got very angry, and do remember in the 1930s, the American anger, the mass of people's poverty and unemployment, made them do something they haven't done now, at least not yet. Millions of Americans joined and became active in the socialist and communist parties in our country. And that made a difference. And that frightened Mr. Roosevelt, and it frightened the business community, because these people were saying, the problem is capitalism, and maybe we ought to get rid of it. So suddenly something had to be done, and suddenly Mr. Roosevelt did things. The first thing he did was to respond to the problem of unemployment in a novel way. He hired people. Mr. Obama hasn't done that yet. Mr. Obama keeps talking about stimulating private enterprise to hire more people, which isn't working, hasn't been working for the last 15 months. Roosevelt tried it, didn't work for him either. So Roosevelt came in and said, okay, the government's going to hire the people. We're not going to have millions unemployed, all the capacity, the machines idle, the raw materials rotting. We have terrible social needs. We're going to put these people to work. We're going to use the material. We're going to produce. People who are working can pay their mortgages, so we won't have the home foreclosures, et cetera, et cetera. So the government came in and hired millions of people. This is not some socialist dream. This is, I'm describing to you what we did in our country by a president who was not a socialist, to say the least. What did he have the American people do? Many Americans I speak to don't know. It's interesting we don't. Let me tell you two things. One was called the Civilian Conservation Corps, a very interesting group of people who were hired for what we would nowadays call environmental work. To rebuild dikes, to redirect rivers, to rebuild foundations in areas that were undercut by water and so on. Many of them built the national parks in the West that many of you visit to enjoy those beautiful parks. Those were built by government-employed, unemployed workers. And the second big program that was really fascinating was called the WPA. The WPA was the following clever idea, just to show you how creative we could be. Artists of all kinds that were unemployed were hired by the government. Singers, actresses, painters, sculptors, you name it, were hired. The government created roving troops of theater people, opera people, concert whole concert orchestras, and they were sent by the paid by the government to rehearse and practice and put on concerts and put on shows of how to sculpt and how to craft and how to whittle wood and all the other things that go into arts and crafts. And it, all across America, in little towns and villages that had never had any cultural activity at all, professional, skilled artists came. The United States never had such a flourishing of cultural activity in its country before, and we've never had it since. Millions of people went to work. Think of it. What an interesting idea. Today, it's not even discussed. So one of the first things I would say is, why are we not looking at the actual things we have done in the past and instead allowing people to go through the pain and the misery and all of us the loss of what 15 million unemployed people mean? But I would go much further. And I'm going to leave you with that. I think an economic system that works in the ways I've just gone through with you, that ends up sending money to China, that leaves people unemployed, that leaves people losing their homes. You know, we are a wonderful country. We now have a record number of homeless people side by side with a record number of unoccupied homes. We are a country in which we line up the homeless people to stare across the street at the empty homes. This is crazy. What is happening here? A society that does that twice in a major way in 75 years, and there were 12 business cycles between the end of the Great Depression and the crisis now. A system as unstable as this, as costly socially as this, is a system that this population ought to have the courage to question. The Cold War is 20 years behind us. 20 years ago, Americans were afraid to question capitalism because that might make you disloyal and be a proponent of communism or socialism. The socialism and communism of Russia is over, of Eastern Europe is gone, and the Chinese look more like us every day anyway. So maybe now we can have the courage to say, can't we do better? Can't we do better than this? Do we have to live with this? What would be an alternative? Suppose we organized business differently in the United States. Instead of having the majority of people in every job come to work Monday through Friday, do the work, go home, leave behind the work they do, so that the people who make the decisions what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, what to do with the profits, are whom in our culture? The board of directors of a major corporation. What is the board of directors? 15 to 20 people, that's the average number. And who puts them in that position? The major shareholders, about 15 or 20 people usually. 15 or 20 people select the board of directors, 15 or 20 people, who tell you what to do, how to do it, when to do it, where to do it. Suppose we reorganized businesses in America so that it worked like this. Monday to Thursday, you come and you do whatever your job has always been. Friday, you come to work, but you don't do your regular job. Instead, all day Friday, you and all the other workers have the following job description. You sit around all day and have meetings, and there you decide together what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. No board of directors, no shareholders. Wow. Guess what would have happened in the 1970s if businesses were run like that? You think the workers would have stopped raising their wages? Unlikely. You think the workers would have moved production out of the country? Unlikely. Our entire economic history would have been completely different. Now, is this a pie-in-the-sky crazy idea that could never work? I don't think so. And here's my proof. Over the last 50 years, groups of American workers have been doing exactly this every year. Many of them. But I'm going to give you one example. It's in a place called Silicon Valley. It's a wonderful part of California, just below San Francisco, running south along the bay to San Jose. It's the center of the computer and telecommunications industry of the United States, indeed of the world. Every year, the following thing happens. Engineers, people who specialize in making software, but also some hardware, quit their jobs They're working for companies like IBM and so forth, big traditional companies with a board of directors that makes all the decisions. They quit the company. They're making good money.
Wolf tells us the engineers can't stand how the company is run, and they can't stand their working conditions. And they say,
so I quit. And together with other people who feel like me, we're all going to take our laptops and we're all going to gather in Harry's garage. And there's going to be a new rule in our new little business. No board of directors, no shareholders. Nobody tells anybody else what to do. We all get together, and Monday through Thursday, that's where I got the example, we come to work and we make software. And on Friday, we don't come to work to make software. We sit around and we decide what to do, how to do, where to do it, when to do it, and what to do with the profits. And when you ask these people, why do you do this? They say two things. I'm a much happier person working in that situation, and I'm much more productive. And I actually went with students and interviewed them. I learned fascinating things. Most of these people are Republicans. And when I tell them, you know, this moving away from a capitalist enterprise and organizing a collective enterprise, that pretty much summarizes the proposal made by this German fellow years ago named Karl Marx. They look at me as if I had just urinated on their shoes. They're really disappointed. They're very unhappy. They don't want to know what I just said.
Richard Wolff, reminding us that communal alternatives to capitalism can work, indeed are now working, in that bastion of American enterprise, the Silicon Valley, among other places. This week and last, we heard large portions of Richard Wolff's long and brilliant lecture, Capitalism Hits the Fan, from December 2009. That's before the Occupy movement proved that many, many Americans have a similar vision of what's wrong with the present. Wolff also discusses the past, exactly how we got into this mess, and some practical things we can do to make the future work better than the present does. If you're hankering to see Wolff's entire two-hour presentation, you can find the video on YouTube, or just click on the handy link you'll find on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Thanks for listening. Illegitimi non carborundum. Imagine alternatives. They've got to work better than what we've got now. And please tune in again next week. Ciao. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic psychotic.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear today was originally aired in the spring of 2015, and here it is. Joining me today on the show to talk more about 9/11 and its aftermath is Stephen Lendman. Stephen Lendman is a writer, syndicated columnist, activist, news, TV personality, and radio show host. He currently writes for MoneyNewsNow.com and VeteransToday.com and hosts, since 2007, a progressive radio show at the Progressive Radio NewsHour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stephen Lendman was born in 1934 in Boston, Mass., raised in a modest middle-income family, attended public schools, received a Harvard BA in 1956 and a Wharton MBA in 1960. After 6 years as a marketing research analyst, Lendman became part of a new small family business in 1967, remaining there until retiring in 1999. Since then, he has devoted his time to progressive causes, extensive reading, and since summer 2005, writing on vital world and national topics, including war and peace, American imperialism, corporate dominance, political persecutions, and a range of other social, economic, and political issues. He's also author of the celebrated books Banker Occupation, Waging Financial War on Humanity, and How Wall Street Fleeces America, Privatized Banking, Government Collusion, and Class War, and just recently a new book called Flashpoint in Ukraine, which is a compilation of 22 geopolitical analysts countering the fraudulent Western narrative on Ukraine and why it matters so much. Stephen Lendman, welcome to the show.
Cheryl, it's good to be on with you.
Yes. Now, you recently wrote an article called 9/11, The Mother of All Big Lies. And you begin the article by stating that lies are an American tradition. Could you explain what that means and give us some examples?
Well, indeed, lies are an American tradition. America does not have exclusivity over what I like to call big lies with a capital B and a capital L. And I refer to them as big lies, because we're talking about, in most cases, either major geopolitical issues or major domestic ones that affect the great majority of people in America. So if America decides to pass an act like the Patriot Act that affects everybody, well, of course, it does not affect the elites of America. It doesn't affect the corporate CEOs or the military commanders or the top officials in government, but it affects everybody else. You could call them the 99%. So these lies have incredible effects on people in America, on domestic issues, or around the world on the major geopolitical issues. As far as America goes, I mean, the big lies literally date from the Republic's inception. Big notable ones I mentioned in my article began in the mid-19th century when America annexed half of Mexico. America became Cuba's colonial power, and many other small independent nations came under America's control after that. The Philippines, Guam, Hawaii, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, goes on and on and on. Woodrow Wilson pawned the U.S. Republic into having America into World War I. He campaigned promising to keep America out of the war. My dad was in World War I in France. Thankfully, he came home. But he campaigned as a peace president, just like Obama. He promised no war. And immediately after being reelected in 1916, he formed the Creel Commission that literally turned Americans, pacifist Americans, into raging German haters. It goes on and on and on. Even World War II was very tainted American intelligence tracked the Japanese fleet across the Pacific, but the commander, Commander Kimball in Hawaii, in Pearl Harbor, was not warned because Roosevelt wanted the war. The only way he could turn a pacifist public and a pacifist Congress around was to create a mass casualty event. Well, he certainly got it. 9/11 was a mass casualty event. The Gulf of Tonkin was a famous big lie. Again, it goes on and on. The major things that happen in America or that America does around the world or domestically literally are based on big lies.
Yeah, and why do you say 9/11 is the mother of all big lies?
Because of everything that happened after it. Look what happened after it. We literally waged war on humanity. George Bush, followed by Barack Obama. Afghanistan. There was a debate following 9/11. Did America attack Afghanistan or Iraq first? Afghanistan was chosen just weeks after the 9/11 event. And a very important thing to point out is this. Wars are not waged on the spur of the moment. It takes long planning before a war can be initiated. The Afghan war was planned months before 9/11. It was only a matter of when the trigger would be pulled and the attack would be launched. Well, 9/11, September 11, 2001, about 4 weeks later, the Patriot Act was passed. And 5 weeks later, after 9/11, America attacked Afghanistan. Why Afghanistan? Because it's a strategic asset, strategically important country. It's a country that has strategic importance in relation with Russia. It's sort of like a land-based aircraft carrier where America can base its troops, and America plans permanent occupation of Afghanistan. Most of the troops may be withdrawn, but Obama wants 10 or 20,000 remaining, and they will remain, and they will remain as a hostile force, mainly targeting Russia. Afghanistan is also rich in natural resources, which most people don't realize. It doesn't have a lot of oil. It has a lot of strategic resources. Estimates range that they could be worth as much as $1 trillion. Well, America wants its corporations to get their dirty hands on them. So these are some of the reasons that Afghanistan was chosen.
Of course, then they have the drug.
Oh, indeed. Afghanistan is the world's leading producer of opium, which is the product that goes into heroin. So the CIA makes billions of dollars at trafficking heroin. Another story most people don't know. The Wall Street banks make billions and billions of dollars from drug money. I remember somebody telling a story, a person who used to work on Wall Street, who said every Friday afternoon, the limousines drive up to the big New York banks, Citibank, J.P. Morgan Chase, or Morgan Stanley Brokerage House, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, with suitcases. People get out of the limousines with suitcases. What have they got in the suitcases? Money, drug money, to be deposited every single Friday. This is big business. Mm-hmm. Afghanistan is extremely important. These are the reasons Afghanistan was chosen.
And when it comes to 9/11 or any other of the lies, does it matter which political party is in office, since both parties seem to go along with the cover-up of any of these lies?
It seems to me the Democrats are more warrior-like than Republicans. My God, you could go back in U.S. history, Lincoln the Civil War, Roosevelt World War II, Wilson World War I, Lyndon Johnson, Vietnam. It goes on and on and on. Of course, the Republicans are no slouches by any means. My goodness. I mean, they wage one war after another, and they certainly do it now. And George Bush was the president on September 11th, 2001, and immediately war began. He launched war with others planned. Iraq was the second one in mind. It came in March 2003, the second Iraq war. The first one began in January 2001. Bush Sr. launched that war. So the Republicans are no slouches when it comes to waging war. But you could basically say there's no difference between the parties. And I've said it and I've written many times. On the major issues, there's not a dime's difference between them. And the major issues are simple: war and peace, corporate empowerment, a police state apparatus ruling America, example, the Patriot Act and many others, Homeland Security Act. So basically, both parties are in lockstep. They differ on other issues. They're not unimportant, but they don't rise to the level of the biggest ones.
And can you tell me some aspects of 9/11 that made you question or doubt it? Why do you say it's a lie?
Well, I put in my article, Cheryl, the expert on 9/11, David Ray Griffin. David is an extraordinary man. He's written 10 books on 9/11. He is the expert on the topic. And I quoted from one of his articles. Let me just read what he said. He listed 21 reasons why the official story is a lie. There are a lot more than 21 reasons, but let me just read you the ones that he listed. The FBI admitted it had no hard evidence connecting 9/11 to bin Laden. And by the way, Obama did not kill Osama. Bin Laden died in December 2001 of natural causes. He was a very ill man, kidney problems, other problems, and even Fox News at the time reported it. The BBC reported it. The New York Times reported it belatedly, and I remember quoting them. Around July of 2002, they reported that bin Laden died at the end of 2001. So the story was reported, and then it was buried and forgotten, and Obama claiming he killed Osama was another big lie. I don't know who he killed, but it certainly wasn't bin Laden. Second point by Griffin. So-called devout Muslim alleged hijackers drank heavily, frequented strip clubs, and paid for sex. Third point, technology in 2001 made cell phone calls made from above 30,000 feet impossible. Claims were made that the wife of Ted Olson, I remember, called Ed Olson on her cell phone. Well, she did not, because cell phones at the altitude she was flying at could not get through to her husband, so that was another lie.
And that was verified by the FBI in the Mousawi trial, correct?
I believe so.
That didn't last more than 0 seconds.
Indeed. Another point. The FBI lied claiming Mohammed Atta left behind luggage containing decisive evidence about al-Qaeda being responsible for the 9/11 attacks. False. There was no evidence left behind indicating that, because al-Qaeda and bin Laden and so-called crazed Arabs had nothing to do with the 9/11 attack. Another point, passports allegedly found at United 93's crash site were false. Another point, alleged hijackers were not aboard the four fateful flights. By the way, I want to mention that the black boxes were finally found, and for years they were buried and not allowed to be made public. But there is a code that pilots or co-pilots in the cockpit can activate to alert a problem such as a hijacking. It's called 7500. None of the four pilots, none of the four co-pilots activated the 7500 code, meaning there was no problem, there was no reason for them to activate it. So that's another big lie. Another point, standard operating intercept procedures were not followed. They're very clear, including launching aircraft to go after a suspected. If an aircraft has been hijacked, you would launch aircraft after it, not necessarily to shoot it down, but to stay right with it, to monitor it, and to follow and see exactly what's going on. There were no intercept procedures followed. Another point, then Treasury Secretary Norman Mineta and Dick Cheney apparently confirmed a stand-down order prior to an alleged plane striking the Pentagon. Well, a plane did not strike the Pentagon. A missile struck the Pentagon. There were no bodies. There was no fuselage. There were no engines. There was no plane wreckage. A missile struck the Pentagon. And I remember in an earlier article I wrote years ago, an experienced commercial airline pilot saying it was virtually impossible for an airliner to get through all the obstructions that would have to be navigated to be able to strike the Pentagon. And even if it was possible to do that, the Pentagon has such defenses, they would shoot the plane down, surface-to-air missiles. I don't think any building in the world is more heavily guarded than the Pentagon. The kind of stuff that goes on in that building.
Mm-hmm.
The Pentagon would have shot it down before it ever got close to the building. Well, of course, no missiles were launched to shoot it down because there was no threat. And of course, if it was a missile, which it was, the scheme was to let the missile hit the Pentagon, to be part of the mass casualty event, to let all the things that happened post 9/11 follow. Another point, the 9/11 Whitewash Commission deleted Mineta's comment from its official report. Another point, Secret Service agents let Bush remain at the Sarasota, Florida school for 30 minutes after they learned the second tower was struck. It's supposed to be automatic that if there's any chance of danger to the president, you get him out of harm's way. Well, I would say knocking down two towers was certainly a potential danger that should have gotten Bush out of harm's way, but he stayed for 30 minutes.
Also endangering the students.
Endangering everybody, yeah. Indeed. He was reading a story to the students, and the Secret Service violated what they were supposed to do. They did not get him out of harm's way. Another point, jet fuel does not heat high enough to melt or cause rigid steel columns to crumble.
Mm-hmm.
It simply can't do it. How did the buildings come down? They were rigged on the inside with explosives. The explosives were detonated, and the buildings came down. That's the only way it could have happened. The only question is, what kind of explosives were used? There are some people who think nuclear explosives were used. I don't know, and I don't think conclusive information has come out either way. But the building definitely was rigged with explosives, just like the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City in the mid-1990s, blamed on two individuals. Whether they had any involvement or not, I don't know. But the truck that supposedly blew up the Murrow Building, the FBI building, literally did not do it. The building was rigged. There were many, many buildings in a vast area surrounding the Murrow Building that went down with the FBI building. And in this case, a study was done by an Air Force general at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and the results came out maybe a couple of months after the incident. And an Air Force general exposed the big lie and said a truck bomb did not bring down the building, but there was no such investigation after the 9/11 event. You had the 9/11 commission, but they were paid to lie, not expose the truth. So again, you had a big lie in the 1990s. You had a big lie following 9/11. Official story is entirely different. In Building 7, another big lie. The BBC, Jane Stanley, reported Building 7 coming down 30 minutes before it happened. I don't know whether the video is still circulating, but I saw Jane Stanley reporting Building 7 coming down 30 minutes before it happened, with an image of Building 7 in the background.
Still standing, right.
How the BBC could have done this, I don't know, but they did. Yeah. So another one of the big lies. Jane Stanley, I'm certain, will never live this down. There are so many other big lies. There is an initiative called Consensus 9/11. There are many, many remarkable people involved in it, including a woman who comes on my program, Elizabeth Woodworth. She's connected with David Ray Griffin. And they put together, using forensic evidence, key points that are virtually irrefutable because of the forensic work they do to detail the truth, to expose the official lies. I believe they've come up with 44 consensus points. And these consensus points literally take a specific 9/11 big lie and debunk it. The latest ones were the fact that the 7500 code wasn't activated, the fact that our black boxes on the planes were found where they were buried before, and apparently information came out that they weren't found, but they were found. And if they were found, then why wasn't information on them made public? Information on them would go a further step to proving that the official story was a big lie. It goes on and on, Cheryl.
Yeah, right.
One big lie after another.
Now, in your article, you say that the American dream is more myth than reality, and quote George Carlin, who once said, quote, "You have to be asleep to believe it." Are most Americans still asleep, in your opinion? And if so, why do you think that is?
I think more and more Americans are waking up. Too many Americans are still asleep. But one of the things that encourages me greatly is the fact that cable news services, and I believe the broadcasters, are losing audiences. People are getting fed up with what I call managed news misinformation. They want the real thing. They want to know the truth. They want accuracy on the big issues of the day, major world and national ones, and they're sick and tired of being lied to, so they're tuning out. I guess they still watch other things. They watch movies. They watch the sitcoms. They watch these programs, but they're getting fed up with the daily fare. It doesn't matter whether you turn on CNN or CBS or Fox, you're getting big lies one after another, and they repeat them. The New York Times, same thing. One big lie after another. If you want to know the truth, you've got to go to the alternative media. You've got to go where people will tell you what's going on and explain the things that people need to know. So it's wonderful if people will tune these broadcasters and cable channels out. It's the one industry in America that ordinary people can shut down by their activism. You can't shut down the defense contractors. You can't shut down the automobile makers. You can't shut down the chemical companies, but you can shut down the cable companies, and you can shut down the New York Times. Stop buying their publications. Stop reading them. Stop tuning in to news broadcasts on Fox, on CNN, on NBC. Don't watch. If enough people don't watch, there'll be no advertisers. If there are no advertisers, there'll be no programs, there'll be no news. And the only place people can go for the real thing is the alternative media, like this program, like my own program called the Progressive Radio News Hour, where they'll get the truth and all of the truth.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that is people power in action, and it's something we can all do very simply. Yeah, I appreciate that. Now, certainly the wars and occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan are directly resulting from 9/11. What about the destruction of Libya and the war in Syria? How is that related to 9/11, or is it?
Oh, they're all related to 9/11, Cheryl. Same thing, same pretext for going to war. Afghanistan, the attack on 9/11, which the Taliban had nothing to do with. The second war on Iraq, Bush's Iraq War II, weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist. You couldn't pull off these big lies if you didn't have a reason to do it. And the reason is America's war on terror, protecting the American people from what I call non-existent threats. The only threats that America faces, Cheryl, are the ones it invents. There was no threat from Afghanistan, no threat from Iraq. There was no threat from Libya. Gaddafi, there were many fabrications about Gaddafi feeding his troops by Agra so that his forces could go out and rape women or slaughter the forces and do things like that. Again, one big lie after another. It was shocking what America did to Libya. Libya was an extraordinary country. The vast majority of Libyans supported Gaddafi. And why? Because he gave them the kind of country people like to live in. Libya was the most developed country in North Africa. You could say the same thing about Iraq. Both countries, extraordinarily developed countries, doing wonderful things for their people, providing them things in Libya and Iraq, free education, free health care, free other social services, getting things that Americans can't even imagine. Americans can't imagine getting these things for nothing. But Libyans got them under Gaddafi. Iraqis got them under Saddam. They're all gone because America wanted the countries destroyed, exploited, letting U.S. corporations in to run things. So waging a war on terror, fabricating big lies about how the country was run, and the harm it was claimed these countries were doing to other nations in the region, to American forces in the region, became the pretext for going to war against them. It was true in Libya, it's true in Syria. I rightfully call Syria Obama's war. Syria is Obama's war. He planned it. He waged it. It's got nothing to do with Assad waging war on his people. Nothing whatsoever. It's got everything to do with eliminating an independent leader. America tolerates none. It wants subservient pro-Western leaders it controls. Assad is independent. Obama wanted him removed. Same reason we wanted Saddam removed. Same reason we wanted the Taliban removed. Same reason we wanted Gaddafi removed. To get rid of these people, to put in pro-Western stooge governments, to let them run their countries to serve U.S. interests, corporate interests, imperial interests, and so on.
Does the fact that they had their own banks and weren't connected to the World Bank or any of the other Western banks, was that a part of why we wanted to get rid of those governments?
Oh, absolutely. One of the big crimes a country can commit against America is to trade outside of the dollar. Saddam was trading outside of the dollar in Iraqi currency. Same thing with Gaddafi in Libya. And this is a major no-no. The dollar, as the world's reserve currency, which it is now, is extremely important for America. It funds America's wars. It buys America's bonds. It keeps America's corporations strong. It does all of these things. And if the dollar loses its reserve currency status, then all of these benefits are lost. So if a country dares to trade in its own currency outside of the dollar, it gets targeted for regime change. That one offense alone gets it targeted for regime change.
Now, the situation with the group ISIS, seem to come out of nowhere. Could you help us make some sense of what's going on there with in Syria? You know, we have the rebels, then we have ISIS, and everybody seems to be fighting everybody. Maybe you could tell us who's supporting them and what that's all about.
Well, the most important thing to say about ISIS, Cheryl, is number one, it's a U.S. invention. America invented ISIS the same way as it invented the Mujahideen in the 1980s to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. And the Mujahideen then, whom Ronald Reagan called during a visit of their leaders to the Oval Office, the modern equivalent of our founding fathers. Well, the equivalent of the Mujahideen today in Afghanistan is the Taliban. Same thing. So we see these things repeat. America created the Mujahideen, recruited them. America created Al-Qaeda. America created ISIS or ISIS or the Islamic State. There are many, many, you could call them terrorist organizations. I think that's an accurate way of describing them. There are many of them, small ones with names I don't even recognize, others with names I do recognize, like Al-Nusra. They're all over the region. I think new ones crop up all the time. Some of them are U.S. created. Others may just crop up on their own. But America very definitely is allied with them. The war on terror is part of using these groups to initiate America's agenda, which, of course, is regime change against independent governments, and to further what I call America's imperium, advancing America's goal toward unchallenged global dominance. And this is what America seeks. And it does it by getting these groups to attack foreign countries, the governments of which America wants eliminated, to establish its own control over these countries and regional dominance en route to global dominance. That's what the America agenda is.
In your article, 9/11, the Mother of All Big Lies, you state that America is on a fast-tracked tyranny, perhaps just another false flag away. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I believe it really is, and there are some people I respect very much that say America already has reached full-blown tyranny. One of the most obvious things are the domestic laws that passed in the wake of 9/11, and I wrote about them at the time. One of my early articles, Cheryl, I called Police State America, and I put a subtitle, I Look Back and Ahead. But the Patriot Act, 4 weeks after 9/11, the Patriot Act literally eviscerated three or four of the Bill of Rights. The war on terrorism, a phony war. The war on terrorism is a war of state terrorism against the American people. That's what it really is. And nobody threatens America. There is no nation, there is no group that threatens America. And when Obama makes a statement that ISIL or Al-Qaeda or any other so-called terrorist group threatens America, people should be worried. Well, he's lying. There is no threat whatsoever.
And that was the first part of an interview with author Stephen Lendman. Tune in next week to hear the conclusion of that interview. You can read his articles on the website globalresearch.ca. And also he writes for moneynewsnow.com and for veteranstoday.com. He has a new book out called Flashpoint in Ukraine, which we'll discuss in more detail on next week's show. He also has a blog at www.sjlendman@blogspot.com. And Lendman is L-E-N-D-M-A-N. He also mentioned the fact that we were lied to about the Oklahoma City bombings. A few years back, we showed the movie A Noble Lie about the questions concerning the Oklahoma City bombing. But if you missed that, you can get the film online at www.anoblelie.com. Also, the website whatreallyhappened.org has some good information about the Oklahoma City bombing. And again, the website globalresearch.ca also has articles there posted about the Oklahoma City bombing. I also want to let you know about a new book by retired Canadian professor Graham McQueen. It's called The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy. And you can get it at Clarity Press. I just started reading it, and I highly recommend it. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Nearly 40,000 Verizon workers have hit the picket lines in what would be one of the largest strikes in the U.S. in recent years. The workers are members of the Communication Workers of America, CWA, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, IBEW.
They're fighting aggressive attacks on their compensation, job security, and more, carried out by a corporation that has made $39 billion in profits over the past 3 years.
For my future, for my children's future,
my fight for my family is very important. My fight for my home is important. My fight for my three girls are important. And I go on strike for that.
10 months our bargaining team has been negotiating in good faith, trying to come to an agreement.
Well, the biggest issue for me is the fact that the company wants to basically relocate jobs on a moment's notice. We're all, you know, husbands, fathers, sons, daughters, and when you're asking somebody to pick up and move, in some cases out of state for 4 months at a time, it's nearly impossible.
If I have three boys, my two younger ones really, especially the youngest, you know, they depend on me. You know, I'm divorced, so it's... It's very worrisome. We will stand up for good jobs.
We're ready to fight for good jobs and keep those good jobs in this country and not overseas.
It makes me feel like betrayed. I mean, I gave them a 31 years. I don't think they're holding up their end of the bargain at this point.
I'm actually trained to do FIOs, and I've seen firsthand what FIOs can do for consumers, and I want to be able to do that for my community and my neighbors here. FIOs in this area would be a boon to the economy, it would be a boon to the consumer, and it would be a boon to us as union members.
Verizon seemed to be the poster child for corporate greed.
Corporate greed is them constantly getting raises as executives, building their profits, yet crying poor. I'm worth a good contract. My kids are worth a good contract.
Going off of my parents and their history, they had to go on strike for a few weeks, maybe even a few months. Sacrifice, that's the way to make things better and to get fair treatment and to get fair pay.
To fight for our first contract, it will mean a lot to us because we fight long and hard. And I truly, honestly believe this is something that we have earned and we deserve. Strike.
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 To discuss the issues of the strike, we're joined by Pete Sikora, Strike Coordinator, District 1.
Hey, Mimi. Hey, Ken. It's Pete with CWA here.
Well, let's start with let's parse out some of the wage, the benefit, the working conditions, and the issues of job security that are under fierce attack.
Well, so Verizon wants to destroy what are good jobs and outsource them overseas or to low-wage, low-benefit contractors domestically. So we've lost almost 5,000 jobs in just call centers alone overseas, and Verizon wants to remove what's remaining of the restrictions that they have in our contract to keep that work here in the U.S. with good-paying jobs. That's one of the central issues in the fight. The other is that they want to make it much easier to eliminate technicians from the payroll and replace them with low-wage, low-benefit contractors.
And how are they doing? And how are they trying to, I think, force out the technicians? And what will be the effect on service if they are successful?
Well, so they want to get rid of the most experienced, oldest workers. So they're paid a lot more than low-wage, low-benefit contractors. So what they're proposing is a two-front attack. Number one is get rid of job security language that prevents layoffs by the company. The second thing is that they want to be able to transfer workers out of state up to 2 months at a time. So you could be moved for 2 months away from your family into a completely other state, then come back and then get moved again. So that's a way to drive people off the payroll and replace them with contractors.
Now, we started by saying that in the last 3 years, there's been a $39 billion. I want to make sure we're clear now. We don't talk about millions anymore. It's billion-dollar profit.
So it's a sign of the times. I mean, corporate America here is just bloodthirsty, and Verizon typifies that. This company is making over $1.5 billion a month in profits. This is a spectacularly profitable company that still wants to bust down its workforce, both at Verizon and at Verizon Wireless. The CEO made $18 million last year and has access to a corporate jet. The top five executives made $232 million in just 5 years. So they make over, he makes, the CEO, Lowell McAdam, over 250 times what the average worker at Verizon makes. That's the kind of corporate greed that we're fighting in America and that is resonating with the public. Our fight, we think, is the public's fight.
Well, indeed, and Pete Sikora, I want to just go back and flesh out some of the issues about the medical benefits, the pensions, the disability, the overtime. Tell us what's going on there, too, because they are subject to fierce cutback and take back.
That's right. So we have at Verizon, thanks to about 50 years of union militancy and strength, we have very good benefits, and Verizon wants to cut those and eliminate them. So they had told our bargaining team that their top issue at the bargaining table was to reduce health care costs. And so we've offered over $200 million in health care cost savings. This is a big sacrifice. This is higher deductibles for people, higher co-pays, those kinds of things. And so it turned out that Verizon, no surprise here, unfortunately, was lying. That was not their top priority. They want everything. They want job security, and they want other cutbacks and concessions as well. But the central issue here is good jobs. Are we going to have an America that has a strong middle class, or are we going to continue the trend of pushing people down into poverty and funneling all the money up to the top one-tenth of 1%? That's what we're seeing in America. It's going to stop with this strike, and hopefully we're going to start rebounding here.
I want to follow up on the question of technicians being assigned for over 2 months in some cases away from their jobs to out-of-state locations or locations that are far away. What impact does that have on services to the public?
Well, so Verizon has refused to build out the Fios network, which is the state-of-the-art fiber-to-the-home network. When we had FDR as president, the Rural Electrification Act delivered electricity to all Americans. Everyone got electricity. Broadband is really the kind of equivalent of that today, but because we have corporations in charge of the government, in effect, we don't have the same kind of requirements. So Verizon has picked and chosen where it wants to deploy that technology of fiber optic cable all the way to your home, which is necessary in the 21st century. So they've redlined certain areas. So what that means is that the future of our work is cut off of our members, and customers don't get cable competition. They face a cable monopoly in their area and thus higher prices and worse service. So that's on the Fios side. So there's plenty of work for technicians locally. In addition, there's telephone service, and Verizon has effectively abandoned the telephone network, just letting it rot and deteriorate in place so that service is so bad that that customers just don't retain their telephone. So there's plenty of work to be done by the technicians. In fact, almost all of our technicians work lots of overtime, and that's because they don't have enough technicians to do the work, yet they still want to shift people out of state. That's just an excuse to push them out of their good jobs and replace them with contractors. That's what they want to do.
Maybe to follow up a bit more even, Verizon is seeking to transform the company to be more oriented towards wireless and modeled more on the workplace culture of wireless, which, as I understand it, is overwhelmingly non-union.
That's right, Mimi. So the company's long-term strategy has been to keep the union from spreading in Verizon Wireless, and that's a central issue in this fight. Verizon Wireless workers in Brooklyn and in Everett, Massachusetts, unionized 2 years ago, and they've been fighting for a fair first contract since then. They are also on strike, in a historic first strike in wireless anywhere, as far as we know. There's never been a strike in Verizon Wireless, and this is the first time that retail workers have ever done that. There's also technicians that we represent in the tri-state area who are on strike. Those workers need a fair first contract. Now, Verizon doesn't want to grant it to them because they know that anything that they give to retail workers sets a precedent out of those 65 workers for all the tens of thousands of other non-union Verizon Wireless workers. So we're on strike, and those workers are on strike in a fight that will affect all of the non-union Verizon Wireless workers who deserve a raise just as much as the unionized ones who are out on strike do. So at the bargaining table at Verizon Wireless, they have offered no raises, no improvements in benefits, and no changes in working conditions. Now, at the wireline table, at those bargaining tables, they tell the wireline workers, wireless is a lot more profitable than you, so you have to take cutbacks. But at the wireless table, they don't suddenly say, oh, you're super profitable, you're even more profitable than the wireline workers, so we're going to give you a really good raise. Oh, no, they say status quo, we're going to push you down too.
And what are the conditions for workers in the wireless stores? I mean, do they get health insurance? What is the pay like? And I've heard stories about intimidation by supervisors toward the workers.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of issues, unfortunately, in working conditions. So without a union, you can be dismissed for any reason whatsoever, from the color of your hair to the boss is just in a bad mood. But with a union, you have the right to contest favoritism and unjust dismissal. So that's one of the things that the wireless workers are fighting for, is to overturn a culture of favoritism and, unfortunately, in some cases, sexual harassment. This is a young workforce with young managers who, unfortunately, there's a lot of harassment issues. There's many other working conditions that people want to be able to address through a fair bargaining process, but the company has no interest in it. They want to retain all the power, even to the extent that that it allows managers to do whatever they want, including favoritism and sleazy practices like that.
So I just also want to understand, it seems that the vision of Verizon is really a migratory, if you will, workforce that follows the work from state to state. Now, I know there's a two-tier system already that was really forced upon the union. Does this mean that all the workers would be subject to this migratory, this transfer pattern? Is there no longer any protection, regardless of the tier that you find yourself in, for the workers in terms of their job security, security being also the terms and conditions of their employment?
Yeah, basically, unfortunately, the answer is basically yes. There's a few workers who work in central offices who would not be transferred around, at least not in the short term, until the company decided to potentially close that building. But everybody else would be open to being moved around. And for call center workers, let me be really specific here. The New York State contract, for example, right now requires that 82% of call customer service calls generated in this area stay in this area. And that's good for customers who don't have to talk to someone who may not be very well informed about local conditions. But it's also good for the workers because it maintains their work locally. The company wants to reduce it to 0%. So that's how they would be able to outsource all of the work overseas. They'd simply be able to move all those calls and transfer them to the Philippines and to India and to Mexico and other countries where they have call center work. Now, we have nothing against workers in other countries. We support them as well, but we want to preserve good American jobs here in this country. This is all part of a pattern that you talk about all the time on your program of the corporations and the very, very rich shoving down everyone else in order to pad their own pockets. Verizon, in last year alone, did $13 billion in stock buybacks and dividends to their shareholders. purely stuff to pump up the value of their stock price rather than invest in a profitable product like Fios. Literally, they're not willing to spend money on Fios so that they can pump up the price of their stock in order to pump up the CEO's salary and the other executives and the board of directors at the expense of their own bottom line in the long run.
Well, aren't they cutting down on the call centers by making the workers migrate 35 or 70 miles a day to some of these call centers and therefore paving the way for outsourcing?
Yes, that's right. So one of the things that they want to do is close down particular call centers and move them and consolidate them. So that would mean that the workers who are in that area would face a very difficult choice of lengthening out their commute dramatically. So that's got very serious impact on people's lives. Another big problem in the New York City metro area is that they have begun a system of really inquisitions on the job where they pull people in for up to 2 hours at a time, often 2 hours at a time, of very detailed questioning by management about everything that they did during the day. It's a on-the-job kind of harassment technique that has absolutely incensed our membership. And it's outrageous. It's just, imagine being pulled in by your boss for 2 hours and just questioned on every single thing that you did throughout the day, from simple to complex, essentially in an effort to force you off the payroll by making the job so unpleasant that you just leave.
You know, I'm wondering, I don't want to be too theoretical or too kind of nihilistic about this, but, you know, as there is a technologizing and robotization and artificial intelligence, et cetera, and you can begin to see that certainly in an industry like Verizon, it's so on. Do you need to begin to actually force into the union contracts even before some of these things occur? And in anticipation of these models taking place, something more aggressive that preserves the workers' rights, just a whole new panoply of issues that the working class has really got to face in conjunction with technologies that can leave them in a state of precarity or possibly joblessness?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. Technological change has always been here with us, but what's really changed is that labor law is so backward in America that we cannot organize in the private sector in places where the company simply decides, well, you know what, we're just going to fire people. Sure, it's illegal. Sure, we'll have to restore their jobs 5 years down the line when the NLRB and the courts order us to, but we're just going to get rid of people now. Now, in Verizon, the workforce essentially has shrunk at wireline while wireless has grown. CWA pioneered the strategy of bargaining to organize. So we worked very hard a few contract rounds back to get a neutrality agreement. This was completely new at the time. It's a new concept, really, for unions, in order to get an agreement that Verizon Wireless, that we could organize there without the company threatening people and trashing the union. Well, we thought we had an agreement, but it turned out that Verizon did not follow that agreement. And so ever since then, we've been fighting to get those same conditions at Verizon Wireless, where people would be able to make a free choice, not subject to harassment by their management, in which case they would then choose to form a union. But we haven't been able to win that. So what we have won is an election in Brooklyn and Massachusetts in order to represent the wireless store workers. So that's where the employment is, and that's where we want to win a fair contract for those workers, which then sets a precedent for the rest of the company. The company knows that just as well as we do, and they want to keep those workers non-union and without a good contract so that eventually they can beat back the union from its beachhead within Verizon Wireless. And that's to the long-run benefit of them, obviously, and hurts the Verizon Wireless workers at Verizon and across America, because if Verizon can succeed in pushing down workers in Verizon Wireless, they'll be able to continue to shove down the middle class in America and funnel money back up to their own pockets and up to the top 1% and 0.1%.
Pete, recently the strikers picked up some serious support from presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, who joined them on the picket line.
We're fighting a vicious corporation. But we got a champion that's fighting for us. Let's hear it from Bernie Sanders. Thank you for your courage in standing up for justice against corporate greed. Verizon is one of the largest, most profitable corporations in this country, but they refuse to sit down and negotiate a fair contract. They want to take away the health benefits that you have earned. They want to outsource decent paying jobs. They want to give their CEO $20 million a year in compensation. They want to avoid paying federal income taxes. In other words, this is just another major American corporation trying to destroy the lives of working Americans. And today, you are standing up not just for justice for Verizon workers, you're standing up for millions of Americans who don't have a union. And you're telling corporate America they cannot have it all. And you're telling corporate America that workers in this country are not going to be continued to push down and down and down. The working class of this country deserves to earn decent wages, decent benefits, and not see their jobs go to low-wage countries. I'm here today not just to support the CWA. I know how hard it is, what a difficult decision it is to go out on strike. And I know you're feeling a whole lot about it. And I know your families are going to pay a price for going out on strike. But you have chosen to stand up for dignity, for justice, and to take on an enormously powerful special interest. So on behalf of every worker in America who is facing the same kind of pressure, thank you for what you're doing. We're going to win this thing. Thank you.
And CWA has come out in support of Bernie in the Democratic primary. Talk about why CWA has given its support to Senator Sanders.
Well, you know, we had a vote of our membership online. We're very proud of the fact that we put it to the membership, and the membership voted decisively to endorse Bernie Sanders. We believe in a political revolution. We think that that's what this country needs. We need a candidate who is not beholden to super PACs and big money to make the kind of decisions that will actually benefit working families. Bernie Sanders has the kind of record where you know that he wakes up every day thinking about inequality and how to fight for working people. It just is very clear that the man is absolutely single-minded about that, as well as other vital problems. He really cares. You can tell it. He has the record to show that, and that's shown in this strike where Bernie has showed up at picket lines, has spoken out at them, has talked about it constantly at his rallies, and really, really strongly supports us. Now, that's not to take away from where Hillary Clinton has been. She has also visited a picket line, but her record, while good on many issues, is just not as good as Bernie Sanders' record. We strongly support him, and we hope that everyone who's listening votes for Bernie Sanders.
And along with that, you had a mass rally today. Tell us a little bit about who else showed up and the kind of support that's being generated.
You know, other unions and community groups showed up and elected officials showed up. But what was really remarkable about it was how many people came and how energetic it was. You know, we expected thousands, and we got 7,500, according to the police. And so, you know, who knows?
We'll double that. That's 14.
There you go. They typically lower things. We thought it was about 10, but nonetheless, we were blown away by the turnout. It was a huge rally, and it was incredibly energetic. In fact, I lost my voice at the rally. So.
Well, as well you should. That's what a strong union strike leader does.
Oh, it was intense. I mean, people are really angry at the company. It's clearly a really raw deal that the company's trying to shove down our throats, and we're just not going to take it. And people really made that clear. Now, Verizon, over the last 15 years, five out of those 15 years actually paid negative federal taxes despite multi-billion dollar profits in each of those years. They actually got refunds from the federal government. So unlike you and me, who pay reasonable federal taxes, these guys paid only 12% over the last 15 years despite gigantic profits. They're supposed to pay 35%. But, of course, they're tax evaders. So they treat their workers, their customers, and the taxpayers just as badly, all of them together.
And, Pete, what's happening next in the campaign to protect Verizon workers?
We are going to be picketing at Verizon Wireless stores as long as it takes here. We are bracing for a long strike here. We're ready for it, and so are our members, and we're going to be out there at Verizon Wireless stores. So people should go to standuptoverizon.com. You can see where all the picket lines are, actually most of the picket lines, and just join a picket line. Come out and show support for the workers. They'll really appreciate it. Come and show your support. Sign up for our list, and we'll send you updates.
Is there something else that we can also do as we conclude this brief but informative interview? And it is a pep rally for our sisters and brothers, the Verizon workers. So can we, is there someone we should call to tell them what to do with their $39 billion in profit?
You know, the thing to do is to go to a picket line and support workers. There's other things to do on the website, sign petitions, circulate them online to your friends. Those are really helpful things to do. Really appreciate having me on this program. But I'll just conclude by saying that this strike isn't just about Verizon workers. It's about, we think, a growing movement of fast food workers, Americans, immigrants, citizens, non-citizens, union, non-union, all who are realizing that we've got to change the way that our economy functions so that the middle class starts to grow again rather than shrinking. And so whether it's fast food workers striking or Verizon workers striking, we're all in this together, and we got to go out and show it. So voting for Bernie Sanders, we feel like it's the same movement moment. Go out there and vote for Bernie. Support the strike. They're flip sides of the same coin.
And can we ask you just to end by, can you recite the best chant that you have?
Sure. What are we fighting? Corporate greed. That's our call and response.
Wonderful.
And we've been speaking with Pete Sikora, strike coordinator of CWA Region 1, who is fighting corporate greed, and we are too.
Thanks so much, guys.
Pleasure.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
After listening to people's feedback during the past several weeks on this issue, I am taking action to affirm the state's commitment to privacy and equality.
It's just not a good thing to hurt people.
Folks stay hidden, especially in the more rural areas. They make pilgrimages, if you will, to places like Little Rock, just so they can find places where they can express their true selves.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Activists attack the constitutionality of Kenya's sex code, North Carolina's governor digs in despite derision, and a trans activist defends Arkansas's local anti-bias laws. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending April 16, 2016. LGBT rights activists in Kenya have filed a first-ever challenge to the East African nation's penal code statutes that punish carnal knowledge against the order of nature with up to 14 years in prison. Gross indecency with another male is punishable by 5 years in jail. The laws date back to 1930. Eric Gatari, who leads Kenya's National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, says those laws violate constitutional rights to equality, dignity, and privacy, and make it socially acceptable to persecute, intimidate, and extort sexual minorities. The petition itself charges that the laws degrade the inherent dignity of affected individuals by outlawing their most private and intimate means of self-expression. President Uhuru Kenyatta told Barack Obama during the U.S. president's visit to his ancestral homeland last year that there are some things that African cultures or societies just don't accept. His government said it prosecuted 595 people under the anti-gay statutes between 2010 and early 2014. In 2015, Gatari won the right in court to officially register his group, but the government refuses to accept the ruling. According to Reuters, Gatari is also involved in a case challenging the government's use of forced anal tests to prove that two men in the city of Mombasa had had sex. He told the news agency that the petition in that case would be heard in October.
A court in China has refused to hear the country's first marriage equality lawsuit. Sun Wenlin and Hu Mingliang filed suit against the Civil Affairs Bureau in the Hunan provincial capital city of Changsha, after the couple's application to register their union on June 23rd last year, their one-year anniversary, was rejected. To the surprise of many, a district court agreed earlier this year to consider the lawsuit. But the judge dismissed the case on April 13th, just a few hours after the hearing began. The couple's lawyer, Shi Funong, said he expected the case to fail, but not so quickly. He told Agence France-Presse that denying same-gender couples the right to civil marriage goes against the spirit of the laws of the People's Republic of China. He said the couple plans to appeal the decision. The New York Times reported considerable support for them on social media. It quoted user Garden on the Roof on Weibo, China's equivalent of Twitter, who wrote that, "Being able to knock open the court's door is already a victory. Keep going." Hundreds also gathered outside the courthouse before the hearing to show their support. Homosexual acts were decriminalized in China in 1997, and lesbian and gay people were subsequently removed from the official list of mental disorders. But sexual orientation remains a dicey subject in the world's most populous nation.
Meanwhile, the Roman Catholic Church has pressured some of Australia's biggest companies to stop promoting marriage equality. Sydney Archdiocese business manager Michael Diggs sent a form letter to many of the more than 800 companies that have pledged their support for the group Australian Marriage Equality. The letter questioned Whether it is the role of a corporation such as yours to be participating in such an important matter that impacts all of Australian society now and into the future. Telecom giant Telstra seems to have buckled, though it denies that pressure from the church prompted any policy change. A press statement reaffirmed the company's commitment to diversity, but said that because of the impending civil marriage equality plebiscite, we have no further plans to be active in the debate. Telstra seems to be alone this far in cutting back on its public support for marriage equality. The openly gay chief executives of Qantas Airlines and national broadcaster SBS were also targeted. Alan Joyce and Michael Ebade, respectively, have each argued that civil marriage equality is an important corporate issue because it would help retain or attract LGBT talent to Australia. Joyce told the Sydney Star-Observer that, if you're unhappy with the company that's involved with the campaign, you won't be able to bank and you won't be able to fly anywhere.
North Carolina's embattled Republican Governor Pat McCrory continued his efforts this week to defend the anti-queer law he signed in late March, HB 2. It forces trans people to use the bathroom that corresponds to the gender on their birth certificate rather than the facility they feel most comfortable in, the only provision McCrory wants to talk about. He continues to insist that the law did not take anyone's rights away, even though HB 2 also specifically overturned an LGBT civil rights ordinance in the city of Charlotte and banned any other local government from passing similar protections. That hasn't stopped more and more companies from refusing to do business in the state, and a growing list of entertainers, including Bruce Springsteen, Ringo Starr, Mumford & Sons, Annie DeFranco, Cirque du Soleil, and comic Joel McHale, have either canceled gigs in the Tar Heel State or donated the profits from their shows to local LGBT advocacy groups.
Meanwhile, Mississippi's Republican Governor Phil Bryant, who signed a law this week allowing parishioners to carry guns in church, also continues to defend his state's so-called religious freedom law. It allows people in both the private and public sectors to discriminate against sexual minorities or anyone else they don't like based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction. The law, enacted in late March, has already cost the hospitality state significant tourism dollars, and its trade association joined a growing number of businesses this week urging lawmakers to repeal it. Out lesbian Robin Roberts of ABC TV's Good Morning America is a Mississippi native. Ironically, she graces the cover of this year's Mississippi Tourism Association guide. In a statement condemning the anti-LGBT law, she noted that she agreed to be on the cover last year, well before recent events.
Tennessee's Republican Attorney General Herbert Slattery has announced his opposition to a so-called bathroom bill currently being considered in the state legislature. He warns that its passage could cost the volunteer state millions of dollars in federal funds. Obama administration officials have already announced the possible loss of funding in North Carolina and Mississippi because of their discriminatory laws. The proposal in Tennessee, echoing the bill passed in North Carolina, criminalizes trans people who use the public facilities, such as bathrooms and locker rooms, that match their gender identity rather than what their birth certificate says. Republican Governor Bill Haslam has also expressed concerns about the bill jeopardizing federal funding, but hasn't said if he would sign or veto it. And opposition from the business and entertainment communities to the anti-trans measure also continues to put pressure on the Republican-dominated legislature to abandon it. Like the literally hundreds of anti-LGBT bills infecting a number of states this year, the Tennessee measure is seen as an attempt to push back against the U.S. Supreme Court's June 2015 civil marriage equality ruling.
But Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards, a Democrat, issued an executive order this week rescinding the anti-gay edicts of his predecessor, Bobby Jindal. The far-right Republican had issued religious freedom orders allowing discrimination against sexual and gender minorities. Governor Edwards, who took office in January, also banned anti-LGBT bias by government contractors. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf issued a similar order protecting LGBT state workers from discrimination last week. These pro-LGBT actions are no doubt a response to the anti-queer laws being passed or considered in other states.
And finally, the makers of Wheaties may be a bit late to the corporate pool party, but they finally dove in. The company announced last week that four-time Olympic gold medalist Greg Louganis would appear on the orange-colored cereal box as part of a new Wheaties Legends series. The openly gay, HIV-positive diver, now 56 years old, has speculated that homophobia was most likely why General Mills, the maker of Wheaties, didn't make him a cover boy after his 1984 and 1988 Summer Olympics triumphs. But he told the New York Times that finally getting on the Wheaties box might truly be better late than never. "This means so much more than it would have back then," he said. "Getting it now means people will see me as a whole person, a flawed person who is gay, HIV positive, with all the other things I've been through." He expressed his elation during a promotional interview distributed by General Mills.
"I think it's really incredible to see how far we've come as far as human rights and acknowledging love, respect. I mean, I'm legally married now to my husband, and we've been married for 2 years. And, you know, it's just, I never thought I'd see this day."
And now Wheaties Legends Series Box. How about that?
"Now Wheaties Legends Series Box. Amazing."
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 16th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org. where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Carol Myers.
This is a huge battleground here in the state, and there are progressive pockets here in Arkansas.
Defending Arkansas's progressive pocket protectors later in the program. The pastoral political melodrama sparked by North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory's signing of HB2 grows more purple by the day. McCrory continues to justify the bill that overturned the city of Charlotte's LGBT civil rights ordinance and banned other local governments from enacting similar protections. Insisting that HB2 does not take away rights, he only addresses the part of the law that bars trans people from using bathrooms, locker rooms, and other public facilities that correspond to their gender identity. Pacifica Radio's Mark Miracle reported on the Republican governor's latest floundering dig-in-his-heels defense.
McCrory announced a change to parts of a new law that eliminates anti-discrimination protections for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. McCrory ordered protections for state employees based on sexual orientation and gender, and he asked North Carolina lawmakers to restore the right to sue over discrimination.
North Carolina proudly welcomes all people to live, work, and visit our great state. We didn't become the ninth most populous state in the nation by accident. We have long held traditions of both ensuring equality for all our citizens and visitors, while also respecting the privacy of everyone. We are also a state that strives to allow our people and businesses to be as independent as possible without overreaching government regulations. These North Carolina values of privacy and equality came into conflict recently when the Charlotte City Council passed a new mandate that forced on businesses a citywide ordinance of bathroom and locker room regulations, something, frankly, we had never seen or had before in that great city or in North Carolina. Simply put, this government overreach was a solution in search of a problem. In fact, Charlotte City Council rejected this proposal less than 1 year ago. The state took action on what was seen as government overreach. You know, after listening to people's feedback during the past several weeks on this issue, I have come to the conclusion that there's a great deal of misinformation, misinterpretation, confusion, passion, and frankly, selective outrage and hypocrisy, especially against the great state of North Carolina. But based on this feedback, I am taking action to affirm the state's commitment to privacy and equality. To that end, today I have signed an executive order with the goal of achieving that fine balance. It maintains common sense, gender-specific restroom and locker room facilities in government buildings and in our schools. And when possible, it allows for facilities for those who have unique or special circumstances. I have affirmed the private sector and local government's right to establish its own non-discrimination employment policies. And as governor, I have expanded our state equal employment opportunity policy to clarify that sexual orientation and gender identity are included. Simply put, I have listened to the people of North Carolina, and the people of North Carolina are entitled to both privacy and equality. We can and we must achieve both of these goals. Now, I know these actions will not totally satisfy everyone, but the vast majority of our citizens want common sense solutions to complex issues. This is the North Carolina way. Thank you very much, and may God continue to bless the great state of North Carolina.
Deutsche Bank is just the latest in a growing number of major companies pulling out of the Tar Heel State. Entertainers ranging from Bruce Springsteen to Cirque du Soleil are either canceling their North Carolina performances or donating the profits to local LGBT advocacy groups. Equality North Carolina's Chris Scrow led the chorus of those who were less than impressed with the governor's homily.
Some of the provisions in his executive order actually double down on the worst parts of House Bill 2. We need a legislative fix. We don't just need an executive order. I very much doubt that this is going to do much to assuage the concerns of the business community, but we do look forward to continued conversation over non-discrimination protections with Governor McCrory.
Charlotte employment attorney Kevin Murphy told Time Warner Cable North Carolina that McCrory's executive order is too little, too late.
What it doesn't do is tell the world that North Carolina doesn't discriminate against folks for being gay or for being transgender. It's still legal to discriminate in this state in public accommodations and employment based on those two grounds. The governor doesn't exactly have authority to wipe away HB 2 unilaterally through this executive order the way he did have 3 weeks ago when it was his choice to veto the legislation or allow it to go through.
I think the governor needs to go farther than where he's gone, and I hope he will. It has damaged our credibility in the nation so bad and hurt our credibility with businesses. We just can't afford to lose these jobs.
Democratic State Representative Billy Richardson told MSNBC this week that he plans to introduce a repeal measure in the upcoming legislative session.
We're coming up into our short session in 2 weeks, and I would hope and pray that we as a deliberative body would come together and work towards resolving this. It's just not a good thing to hurt people.
We leave North Carolina, for now, with this YouTube parody posted by Daniel Cook.
Today I have signed an executive order with the goal of achieving that fine balance of misinformation, discrimination, outrage, and frankly, sexual confusion. Second, I have affirmed the government's right to overreach your private sector. We can and we must achieve both of these goals. Now, I know these actions will not totally satisfy everyone, but the vast majority of our citizens want common sense government overreach. This is the North Carolina way, and may God continue to bless common sense discrimination and hypocrisy, the great state of North Carolina.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis.
Hi, I'm Margaret Cho.
Hello, this is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm Kate Clinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
Hi, I'm Clive Barker.
This is Essex Hemphill.
This is Judy Shepard.
Hello, this is Ian McKellen.
Hi, this is Janice Ian.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, and you've discovered
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
The international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
The confrontation over anti-discrimination laws in Arkansas that has been simmering since last year has come to a boil. This Way Out correspondent Abby Dees learned the latest from a queer activist well known for her own stand against injustice in the state.
The newest front in the fight for LGBT rights might be almost where it began, with LGBT rights opponents finding ways to stop local and city anti-discrimination ordinances. In Arkansas, the Attorney General filed a challenge to the city of Fayetteville's voter-approved anti-discrimination ordinance. She said the local law violates a state law enacted last year that, like North Carolina, prohibits local governments from extending civil rights protections beyond those offered by the state. And of course, Arkansas does not offer protections based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Via Skype, I got to talk to one Arkansas resident who has been fighting back.
I'm the Reverend Gwen Fry, and I am an Episcopal priest in the Diocese of Arkansas. I've been a priest for 25 years and recently transitioned from male to female. And in that process, I lost my position in the church that I was working in.
Since the state ban, Act 137, was passed, a number of cities in Arkansas have passed LGBT civil rights ordinances, almost like they're saying, bring it on. What do you think this says right now about the people of Arkansas and LGBT rights?
This is a huge battleground here in the state. And one of the things that it says, especially about Fayetteville and some of the other cities that have passed ordinances, is that there are progressive pockets here in Arkansas, especially in Fayetteville, where the University of Arkansas is located. And it shows that there is some progress here in moving towards justice for all people.
Act 137 also goes by the name, I love this, the Interstate Commerce Improvement Act, which just on its face seems so unremarkable. And the act itself doesn't mention religious liberty. It doesn't even mention LGBT people. And its stated purpose is to create uniformity of law so businesses won't be confused about what they're supposed to do, I suppose. Do you think there's any validity to that?
None whatsoever. And it was a slick way to get the legislation passed, actually. One of the things with Act 137 is even though it legislates that no municipalities or counties can pass any NDOs, it in and of itself is unconstitutional.
Right.
The legislature passed a law that protects LGBT folks against bullying. So we are already a protected class in the state. The Attorney General really doesn't have a leg to stand on. So we are looking forward to her appeal.
And I'm guessing that they forgot when they did this about the anti-bullying legislation or didn't think anybody would notice that there is, like you said, already state protection. And I know that the city attorney of Little Rock came out and said, oh, well, yeah, we can pass an anti-discrimination ordinance because there is protection for LGBT people in Arkansas. What do you think's happening behind closed doors? Because I'm sure they didn't plan on this.
I think some of the folks who really pushed this legislation at the state level really did not expect this loophole to appear, and they didn't do their homework, and this is allowing us to fight back and using the Constitution, the rule of law, in our favor.
Shortly after Act 137 passed, Arkansas also passed one of the most sweeping religious freedom restoration acts on record. People have said that Arkansas is now, because of these laws, one of the most anti-LGBT states in the country. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I do, because we're in the South and we're in the Bible Belt. It's a difficult place to live for the LGBT community here. There are a few pockets of progressive life here in the state. Little Rock and Fayetteville and also Eureka Springs are really more open and accepting than other places in the state. As a trans woman, I will not go to certain areas of town or definitely will not travel alone if I'm driving across state or things like that. Here in the state, Southern Baptist in particular, Church of God, Assemblies of God, some of those traditions are really scared of some of the changes that are being made and improvements that are happening for all people here in the state and across the country.
To a well-meaning person of faith, and I'm actually thinking, for example, of my in-laws who are from a rural community and good people, who love my partner and me and have been very embracing, I could see that if you explained what a religious freedom law was to them, they would say, this is common sense. They would have a hard time seeing how damaging it could be.
I think everybody's religious freedom is very important. I also think that an individual's religious freedom ends at the tip of their nose. Through having those conversations and discussing with people that while they have the freedom to believe what they believe and practice the religion that they practice, we in America all have that same freedom. We have the freedom to be whatever religious tradition we wish to be, or we have that freedom to not be religious whatsoever. And because that is the America that we live in, they have to respect that. It really goes back to our founding fathers.
Have these laws, do you think, led to an increase in violent actions, or are people more afraid, do you think?
Yes, they are, and especially in the trans community, although it's true for the entire LGBT community, folks stay hidden, especially in the more rural areas. They make pilgrimages, if you will, to places like Eureka Springs and Fayetteville and Little Rock, just so they can find places where they can express their true selves and be themselves.
Do you think some of the anti-LGBT rhetoric has kind of backfired in a way, in that people are motivated to take a stand, maybe even just on their street, people who wouldn't otherwise have done that?
Yeah, I really do think that when we look back on these events in the future, we will see that this legislation and whatnot really was the tipping point for folks really coming to an understanding of how oppressive life is for the LGBT community. And one of the things that I really think is happening, those folks who aren't touched by family members or friends or coworkers who are LGBT, like you said, you know, folks on the street, all of a sudden they're recognizing the fact and seeing that the LGBT community is filled with just common, real people who want to get along in everyday life and live their lives just like they would as straight cis folks.
This is Abby Dees, and I've been talking with the Reverend Gwen Fry about Arkansas's Act 137 and the fight for LGBT equality in her state.
In late breaking news, Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge doubled down this week to thwart the progress of LGBT rights. Her office has filed an appeal asking the state Supreme Court to overturn a lower court ruling in favor of naming both married same-gender spouses on their children's birth certificates. Stay tuned. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Carol Myers, John Dyer V, and Abby Dees contributed program material, with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our special From Outlaws to In-Laws compilation CD, and more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 5UV Adelaide, South Australia, KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, Boise Community Radio, Boise, Idaho, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The decades following World War II were characterized by massive demolition on a national scale. To create suburbs, build a new interstate highway system, and reshape cities in the interests of so-called urban renewal, enormous amounts of land were moved and countless buildings leveled by the wrecking ball. Ecosystems were disrupted, and neighborhoods, frequently inhabited by African Americans and Latinos, destroyed. No object epitomized that destruction more than the bulldozer, which was celebrated in children's literature, toys, and the popular imagination as a symbol of American progress. And, uninterrogated until now, that powerful machine and the culture of clearance associated with it is the subject of a new book out from Yale University Press. It's titled Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance of the Postwar Landscape, and its author is Francesca Russello Ammann. She teaches city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania, and she joins me now. Let me start by asking you about the origins of the word to bulldoze. Where does it come from?
Right. Well, that was something that was a discovery along the process. It has these political undertones, and it referred to people who forced people to vote one way or the other. That was what bulldozing was, and sometimes they used violent means to coerce them into those objectives. And it moved over from that kind of political meaning to this technology. But then as time went on, a technology really imbued with a lot of political meaning itself.
And then what about what we've come to know as the bulldozer? What are its origins?
Well, The bulldozer technically refers to that, metal plow that pushes the dirt or other material at the front of a tractor. We often refer to the combination of the pushing implement and the tractor and that plow as the bulldozer, but it's actually just the blade. And it was originally developed for use in agriculture and moves into construction. And then today, that iconic machine really is what we think of when we use the term.
So one of the arguments that you make in your book is that although the bulldozer was not invented during World War II, and obviously all sorts of technologies were produced in the context of that war, often are produced during wars, but that the bulldozer took on a particular almost cultural role, but also was shaped and kind of reshaped technologically during World War II. So tell us about that history.
Sure. So you're exactly right that this isn't a product of the war in the way that we think of, the atomic bomb and some other technologies. But the war was really a critical catalyst for the manufacturers. They really innovated in terms of the technology at the behest of the military, who were putting these machines into practice, building bases in the Pacific, clearing the rubble of destroyed cities in Europe. And it was really just an opportunity for companies like Caterpillar, International Harvester, and others to make their machines faster, stronger, more efficient, because the military depended upon them. And then after the war, the machine that exists for commercial purchase is a lot better than the one that was there before the war. So it's still the same basic implement, but it's better, and its skills are more obvious, both to the public in the United States, to people abroad, too, as these companies after the war internationalized in a lot of ways, too. So it had a cultural significance, elevating and broadcasting the power of this machine, but it also had technical significance, the war, in changing and improving the implement and the tractors behind it, and all sorts of construction equipment. I talk about the bulldozer as really the iconic machine, but included in this conversation are scrapers and backhoes and, every kind of construction equipment that went along for the ride, too.
What were the naval construction battalions during World War I, also known as Seabees?
So we know the Army Engineers, which is the construction division of the Army, which goes back quite some time. But the Navy didn't have an equivalent organization, and it was during World War II that they created these battalions. They decided they were necessary in part because of all the overseas bases that were going to be constructed in the Pacific, that they couldn't rely just on hiring outside contractors. They really needed to bring those people into the military. And that's when the Seabees, as they're called, were born. Seabees, an abbreviation of Construction Battalion. And the initial men recruited into these roles were already skilled construction men. So they were a lot older than the typical Army or Navy man. And they brought in that expertise because they didn't have it in-house in the military. Over time, though, as those skilled ranks were exhausted, unskilled men start to come in as well into the CB ranks, and they're trained through their military experience. So as I discuss in the book, the war not only improves the machinery, but it kind of spreads the skill set more broadly among a large number of men, among the CBs and in the Army Engineers, who after the war have these skills that they can put to use back home.
In your book, Bulldozer, you include, many images from World War II of the kind of valorization of these heavy earth-moving machines. Where does this imagery really originate from? Was there active promotion by the companies that were producing bulldozers and other machines that were similar? Or was this part of the war effort propaganda? Where did it all come from?
I guess it's a combination of those things. The companies that were producing the machines, most of their output went to the war. So people back home couldn't really purchase them domestically for commercial use. So a company like Caterpillar or International Harvester or Baker or some of these smaller ones, Alice Chalmers, they would continue to market the exploits of their equipment on the war front, with the argument being that once You know, once the war is over, it will be worth the wait. You will be able to purchase a better machine. And look what it's done on the battlefront. Imagine what it will do on the home front. So you have this whole marketing exercise where the companies are very conscious of the fact that the war is going to affect consumers' opinions of these products. They want to keep them top of mind. They don't want the customers to be frustrated. They're having to use this increasingly old and dilapidated equipment that they're even having trouble getting spare parts for. They want to remind them of what their sacrifice back home is yielding on the war front. So the manufacturers themselves spend a bit of money on wartime marketing. And these ads appear in a variety of places, from trade journals that you or I would never see, to Life magazine as well. So they're really widespread, and they're spreading this message broadly. And the military, of course, contributes to this message too. There are embedded journalists who are watching what's going on the battlefield, and they are reporting too in publications like Engineering News Record about the exploits of the bulldozer. And you get lots of journalistic articles. They're not advertisements, but they are effectively. And those stories are published in magazines. They get reproduced in books as well. So these stories perpetuate, and they wind up in films and in novels. So the marketing engine produces lots of different kinds of media that ultimately is celebrating the efforts of these machines that truly were significant to the war effort. But without that broadcasting of those successes, I don't think we would know as much about how significant those efforts were.
How did the degree of destruction from war in Europe influence the idea of what might be possible in the U.S.? And more generally, how did the sort of militarized view of the landscape that was shaped during World War II affect what then happened to the United States afterward?
I think the example of the destruction, as you say, the urban destruction in particular on the European front, it was not something that was celebrated right away, for sure. And I don't think, it wasn't celebrated at all. But it did show people the potential that was there to remake cities if we were to clear away the old version of the city and build anew and implement modernist ideas of architecture and planning. And World War II gave many European cities that opportunity to rebuild. So it planted this seed in many architects and planners' eyes of what was possible in the United States. Now, people had been talking about these things for quite some time, going back to Le Corbusier and others who wanted to remake the city for the modern age, for the automobile, and get rid of the dense, more organic forms of earlier cities. So these ideas were present, but the war showed the example of what actually could happen. So it was really inspirational in certain ways. And you had this movement of designers between Europe and the United States, some fleeing Europe because of the war. And these ideas traveled over to the U.S. So I think the war was really critical ideologically in sowing seeds of destruction as a means towards a clean slate and rebuilding and progress. Again, these are ideas that exist before. People had implemented slum clearance selectively in the United States before, but they hadn't embraced it in such a large way as they would after the example of the war.
Well, of course, the clearing of land, the destruction of pre-existing buildings to build new ones and to create new places, new cities even, the idea of demolition is not a new one. Obviously, before World War II, there was demolition. Why do you think that the period following World War II was so significant? What marks it out?
There are a few factors that really distinguish the post-war moment. And you're absolutely right. We can think about the progressive era, the photographs of Jacob Riis that stimulated tenement reform in the Lower East Side of New York City, and there was clearance for that, the clearance of Mulberry Bend, for example. And then during the New Deal, we also have isolated examples of clearance for public housing. And even Robert Moses got his start before the war, clearing away sections of New York City. So demolition exists as an idea and a practice. But in the post-war period, a couple of important factors really come together to make this a nationwide program of remaking cities. You have the Housing Act of 1949, by which the federal government provides two-thirds of funding to cities who are pursuing redevelopment, or what eventually becomes known as urban renewal. And they'll give that two-thirds funding, provided that you clear away as the first step in your revitalization effort. And so suddenly, lots of cities that had ideas about how to remake certain areas of the city downtown, for example, certain ethnic areas, these ideas existed maybe on a shelf, in a plan on a shelf. But now they had the funding to actually put those ideas in practice. So federal legislation is really key to turning idea into practice. And then combined with that are some of the things that we've already talked about, the example of the war, stimulating people to put ideas that weren't so widely tested in the United States into action on the ground, the advancements in technology and skill sets. So you have lots of people who come home able to do this work, eager to apply for all the different bids that are put out by cities to clear away and then to rebuild. And what I found in my research was that, you know, many of these contractors who are either building, you know, clearing away farms and trees for suburban development or clearing away homes for urban renewal, a fair number of those people have some connections to the war. They served in the Army Engineers, they served in the CBs, and so war, you know, either provided or enhanced the skills that they had at doing these work. So you have the ideology of the war, the technology, these policies that fund it, and then the practice embedded in these individuals who came home from the war effort. All these things come together to distinguish the post-war period as an era of nationwide demolition, not just selected cities who have specific characteristics, but you have hundreds and hundreds of cities participating in this. This was the way to modernize your city in the post-war period, and then remake suburbs as well.
Could you give us any concrete examples of the scale of the kind of destruction that went on to really reshape the landscape of post-war America around suburbs, around highways? What was the scale of the clearing that allowed that to happen?
Well, I looked at census data on the demolition of buildings and found that, you know, somewhere around 5%, 5 or 6% of dwelling units were demolished in the post-war period during the 1950s and 60s. And this is a relatively high figure if you track these numbers over time. This was a peak. But in cities that really implemented urban renewal quite widely, including New Haven, Connecticut, for example, which I chronicle in the book, it was more like one out of every six dwelling units fell. So really dramatic reshaping of formerly dense urban downtowns, really just they were building high-rise towers and sometimes replacing that density in different ways, but getting rid of a lot of the old infrastructure that had been there. So in terms of number of dwelling units, it's quite extreme. But it wasn't just dwelling units. It was also the moving of earth. And really what I'm getting at in this book is this idea of clearance of buildings, clearance of landscapes in order to build anew. Dramatic volumes of earth that were moved to create large flat space for tract housing in the suburbs or to build the interstate highways, which I haven't mentioned yet. You know, hundreds of thousands of tons of dirt, enough dirt on one project that I looked at in Southern California, you know, to fill a football field several stories high each day. And this was going on for decades. And those numbers are a little bit harder to track in terms of the census, volumes of dirt moved. But based on what we can tell in terms of farmland converted to urban use, again, the 60s really are this moment of peak clearance of buildings and land in the United States.
That's the voice of Francesca Ammann. She is professor of city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania, and we're talking about her book, Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance in the Postwar Landscape. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in retrospect, it's often too easy to think that the way American cities and suburbs, the sort of shape that they took, that came from individual decisions rather than federal policy. But of course, the opposite is true, that they were the product of post-war federal subsidies and policies that shaped, as you've mentioned, housing, slum clearance, highway building. And so I'd like to ask you a bit more about particular policies and the effect that they had. Let's start with the GI Bill of 1944. How did that change the post-war American landscape?
Well, it made it a lot easier for large numbers of people to become homeowners. So it increased the appetite for consumption of new homes. So people like Bill Levitt, who was a CB, in fact, who were building large tract developments, the GI Bill helps to provide a large number of consumers for those homes. And there's always been, not always, but there's been since before the war, the mortgage tax deduction, which incentivizes home ownership in certain ways. But the GI Bill made the loans lower rates, much more appealing for individual homeowners.
And you mentioned Bill Levitt. Can you remind our listeners of his signature, Levitt Town?
Yeah, so Bill Levitt is famous for the idea of mass-produced suburban housing. So if we think of Henry Ford mass-producing the Model T for widespread consumption, Bill Levitt was the Ford of the house industry. And there are three Levitt towns: Long Island, there's one in New Jersey, there's one in Pennsylvania, and there are many more communities that are like Levitt Town, these small, economically built boxes with a yard and a garage, where people were often moving from cities to the suburban dream, and Levitt and Levitt towns and places like this supplied the units to fulfill the ideas of those dreams. So Levitt Town is just one example. Lakewood in California is another iconic example, the GI Bill and various other subsidies for home ownership helped to make these things a little bit more appealing.
And of course, Levitt Town is notorious because it was also a place not only that gave shape to the post-war American suburb, but one aspect that characterized quite a few suburbs, which was racial segregation.
Absolutely, yes. And that's an important part of the story that I'm telling, is the racial dimension of this experience of post-war clearance and construction. In the cities where urban renewal was being implemented, the vast majority, about 60% to two-thirds of the individuals being relocated as part of this demolition of dwelling units were minorities, and very often they were African Americans. They were losing their homes in the cities, but they weren't being given access to the suburban dream of home ownership beyond the city's borders. So it's kind of a double-edged price that's having to be paid: losses in the urban realm and then denied access in the suburban realm.
So the bulldozer presumably took on a different sort of imagery and a different sort of cultural sense for those people, African Americans in San Francisco or New York, who found their dwellings bulldozed to make way for highways or for so-called urban renewal. Is this also something that one has a sense of at that time?
It's something that develops over time. And one thing that really intrigued me as I got started on this project was knowing now how so many people have come to fear the bulldozer and equate it with a lot of things that went wrong in the post-war period in terms of the demolition of buildings that could have been preserved, the racial injustices, the environmental consequences of this large-scale clearance, We know all that, but how is it that people got excited about it? And there was widespread support for this idea of clearance and the application of the bulldozer in many of these places. When I looked at New Haven, Connecticut, for example, Mayor Dick Lee was overwhelmingly reelected term after term, people believing in this idea of progress through destruction. But as this plan was implemented in practice, the various injustices became clearer, that the people who were supposed to receive better housing didn't necessarily have that happen, that the people who could move into the new high-rise developments that were constructed, they were only really affordable to certain portions of the population in many cities, not everywhere, but many cities. And so it was the experience of the practice of the execution of clearance that really started to change people's ideas about this machine. And before too long, you have people like Jane Jacobs writing quite eloquently about the wrongs of the bulldozer approach to development, and then everyday citizens rising up in protest as well.
And I'd like to ask you more about that, but just staying with the theme of the federal subsidies that allowed this demolition to happen, can you tell us about the Federal Highway Act of 1956 and what it allowed for, and really the impact socially and environmentally of that act?
Sure. So I mentioned the Housing Act of 1949, by which the federal government covered two-thirds of the costs of clearance. The Highway Act of 1956, under that act, the federal government covered 90% of the costs of highway clearance and construction. So this was even more of a financial incentive to state highway departments to put into action ideas they had about new roadways that they would like. Now, from the top down, there was a map, a set of roadways that would be interconnected to facilitate interstate commerce, but also as a defense mechanism, the idea that if we needed to move tanks and other military machinery in the event of any number of Cold War challenges, that we needed a better system of roadways to make that possible. So it was both commerce and defense that was stimulating this. But that 90% federal funding really spurred states to implement this quickly, to try to get ahead of other states so that they could get, the biggest appropriations, and also to build new highways where they might instead have expanded an existing one or invested in mass transportation, public transportation instead. The funding really oriented states towards the interstates alone and towards new routings of interstates. The result was a lot of clearance through cities, the destruction of many homes in the same way that urban renewal was doing. It's a very similar story. The types of neighborhoods that were often targeted for the highway were often those where the communities had the least political power, and those are going to be your minority populations. Over time, these groups challenge, rise up in opposition, and have increasing success in rerouting or halting the highway, the Seminole Freeway Revolts, as they came to be known. But earlier on, that's where the highway was going through. And then outside of the city, which is, the bulk of the mileage, it's 46,000 miles, the interstate highway network in total, the bulk of those miles are not in cities. And there, the clearance that was realized was a lot of destruction of formerly relatively untrammeled rural terrain. Of course, this is not virgin land by any means, but it was land that hadn't been so developed. And this spurs further development around it at interchanges, but also just the destruction of natural habitats, cutting through hillsides, not just despoiling the vistas that were there, but also damaging the natural stability of the landscape. So the environmentalists really start to push back against some of these development practices too, not necessarily saying that we shouldn't have highways, although some would say that, but that we need to plan them and execute them in a different way. And I characterized it in the book as this kind of efficiency-oriented, pretty technocratic approach to planning the highway routes as driven by the engineers, who really did see this complex challenge of how to lay out the routes, and a straight line was better than one that wasn't straight. You could get more for your money, but that over time, in part due to citizen activism, environmentalists, residents who are going to be affected, increasing appreciation for the fact that there was much more that needed to be considered about the animals that were living there, about the people who were affected, and about the choices for the environment, the costs that were going to result from these engineering-oriented decisions.
Francesca Oman is my guest. We'll return with her in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about post-war clearance and construction. My guest is Francesca Oman. She is author of Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance in the Post-War Landscape. That's published by Yale University Press. She teaches city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania. So I wanted to ask you about, in thinking about the post-war period in the United States, about the connection between demolition, clearance, and economic growth. In Europe and Japan, the destruction of World War II played a significant role in spurring on intense economic growth after the war with Reconstruction. Obviously, in the United States, although a participant in the war, the landscape of the U.S. was not affected by the war itself, but as you point out in your book, we tend to think of the post-war period as a period of construction, and it was equally a period of destruction. So how do you think we should understand the connection between destruction and economic growth in capitalism, and kind of what it tells us more broadly about capitalism and the built environment?
Sure. I think that destruction and construction go hand in hand, but we tend to talk about the construction. And so what I'm trying to do, one of the things I'm trying to do in the book, is to open our eyes to the other side of that decision. Construction doesn't always have to involve destruction. We're much more attuned to opportunities for adaptive reuse and preservation today than we were back in this period. But I wanted to shed light on the violence that really was embedded in some of this growth that equals progress, that it's not progress for everyone, and that there are costs of this. Joseph Schumpeter had this phrase called creative destruction, which he talked about capital's tendency to create, but only as it kind of destroyed and ate up things along the way. The built environment really materializes that more abstract theory that he articulated. We can see this in the way that individual communities were consumed and destroyed as part of the process of economic growth or attempts at economic growth for individual cities and metropolitan areas. So in simplest terms, what we see in the post-war period is just a very material representation or realization of these political economic ideas that typically operate more in the abstract.
Sure, and the creation, of course, gets much more celebration than the destruction, particularly mm-hmm. those who are involved in the process. And one of the things that's so interesting about this whole story is, as you say, the process of demolition involves a kind of an intense violence to a place and to people's lives as well. And yet the celebration of the bulldozer and of these processes was quite remarkable and spills over to this day. So I wanted to ask you about that dimension, the celebration in popular culture of the mechanisms that allowed for the kind of clearance that you've been describing. You open your book with a description of the 1951 young adult novel titled Bulldozer, written by a former ad man for the Caterpillar Tractor Company, Stephen Meter. Can you tell us about that book and what it represented?
Sure. Meter wrote a lot of young adult novels, but this one was about two friends who, young men on the brink of full-fledged adulthood, who start a little business based on a bulldozer that they find abandoned near a pond, I think, while they're out enjoying themselves one day. Ducky, who's one of the friends, had served in the war, actually working with bulldozers, and he sings the praises of Caterpillar and its machines. And then his friend actually is the one who goes on to start the business. And so the book is this kind of inspirational tale for young readers about entrepreneurialism, hard work, the value of American-made technology. But for me, what I really appreciated when I found this young adult novel was how it demonstrated the faith and the optimism that Americans had at this time for the machine, for technology, and for opportunities in the construction realm in terms of post-war American progress. And it was just one example of many that I found in various forms of popular culture of people subtly and sometimes not so subtly celebrating the machine and its potentially violent applications. So I also found many children's books, so not for young adults, but actually for very young readers talking about happy, friendly bulldozers and their operators, a book called Buster Bulldozer, Benny the Bulldozer. More well-known are some books by the author Virginia Lee Burton. Hers are a little bit more complex than some of these others, and they tell multiple sides of the story. But many of the books are very much quite simply a celebration of these machines, of construction work, of the building of highways. One of the books is called Let's Go to Build a Highway, and it ends with asking young readers to come up with other places that they'd like to see a highway. And there's nothing inherently wrong with any of these things, but just the abundance of celebration of this work without carefully probing any of the consequences of what was being lost and what was at stake in clearing away and building so much in cities and suburbs. And only over time, it wasn't until the 60s, the later 60s, do you start to see some other books talking about people resisting certain kinds of environmental damages. A book about a young girl living in Manhattan who's Hispanic, whose apartment building is going to be demolished and the trauma that causes for her. Books encouraging recycling, basic things like that. These aren't the dominant trope in the early post-war period. And so this got me thinking about the different ways that these ideas are embedded in the broader culture beyond people who are inherently talking about and interested in the capabilities of a Caterpillar bulldozer. This is seeping out much more broadly to young readers, to their parents as they're reading with them, and spreading a very positive message without more introspective thinking about what's at stake.
And this era also sees the rise of Tonka toys and all mm-hmm. sorts of little toys that generally are being marketed to little boys more than little girls. But it's interesting that although you argue that American society's view of the bulldozer has shifted over the decades, children's books and toys today still continue very much in that vein, celebrating bulldozers and excavators and road pavers and rollers. Why do you think that hasn't really been affected by, in the mainstream anyway, by shifts in attitudes around the bulldozer?
I think there's just something very exciting about the raw power, the beauty of the technology behind these machines, the excitement of seeing construction in progress, kind of what's going to be there, what's going to be new. There's something very exciting about those things. In the same way that when you think about the automobile and people are much more attuned to the energy side of the story, to the pollution, but still people get excited about car ads. There's just something about some of these technologies that appeals to appeals to us innately and is marketed in a way that makes it appealing. Also, I think just the glossing over of the undersides of some of these things, you know, stories that feature bulldozers, they often do focus on the construction. It wasn't the typical book that was really celebrating the wrecker, although I did find some like that. That wasn't the norm. It was very much about the new post office going up, the new highway. So they simply skip over the more contentious parts of the story. So they're not necessarily making people celebrate that today, but they're helping people to overlook it. So that's a story that I think continues to be more easily swallowed.
Well, that's the bulldozer and similar earth-moving machines in popular culture. What about high art? How did the clearance of the post-war period and the vehicles that were used to do so, how did that influence particular artists?
Yeah, one of the things that I discovered in my research was really just how widely the influence, the cultural influence of the rise of these machines spread. And so if children's books are one end of the cultural spectrum, changes in conceptual art in the 1960s and 70s are kind of the other end. And I looked further into the work of people like Robert Smithson and other artists who were part of the Earthworks movement, who were able to pursue different kinds of artworks because of the capabilities of these machines. So they would go out, for example, into the desert and build, dig deep holes and make art out of the earth, recognizing the great potential of these machines to create art. But often there was a criticism embedded in his work, thinking about how these things will change over time, the disruptiveness of them. So calling attention to this work by leaving the holes empty rather than covering them up with some new building. Other projects of demolishing buildings and capturing those on video, slowing down the process of this work. So they would use the implements, but they would make us stop and think about them a little bit more. And one of the skills of construction workers and equipment is just the speed at which they work. Before you know it, the building is down, and the new construction phase has begun. And so what these artists were doing, Gordon Matta-Clark as well with his work in cities, were slowing time down, forcing us to stop and think and look at the impact of various types of construction equipment. So this is a much more critical body of cultural work versus the children's literature I was talking about before. But both ends of those spectrums kind of transformed by the changes in terms of technology in the construction world.
I'm speaking with the author of Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance in the Postwar Landscape. Her name is Francesca Ammann, and the book is published by Yale University Press. She teaches in city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania. So you have been discussing the policies and practices following World War II into the 50s and 1960s. You've alluded to it a bit, but I'd like to ask you particularly what was happening in the 1970s around this push to clear and construct new buildings. Obviously, a lot changed in the 1970s, including the post-war boom sputtering out with the economic crisis of the early 1970s. Cities were changing and environmentalism was surging. How would you depict the shifts that were going on in that decade relating to the heretofore positive notions, at least in the mainstream, of clearance?
I think it's really, you know, the late 60s into the 70s that we see some big transformations on multiple fronts. It's 1974 when the funding for urban renewal projects dries up. So projects that are in progress continue, and they go into the 80s, but you don't have new projects funded. Instead, spending on urban development shifts to a more ground-up approach, community development funding, such that citizens are given a much greater role in having input to what the plans for their neighborhoods would be. So it's very different from the top-down approach of urban renewal, whereby, you know, the planner, the grand hand of the planner comes in and wipes away what was there and plans anew. This approach is slower, it's more grassroots-oriented, and it's meant to involve citizens much more in the remaking of their own communities rather than relocating citizens to bring in new communities to those places. So that's one piece of how urban planning is changing during this moment. Historic preservation also is starting to come into its own. 1966 is the Federal Historic Preservation Act, which is, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of that act this year. This act is important for recognizing the significance of individual structures that we should think about protecting before we just tear everything down, but also in providing some subsidies, some tax breaks if you do pursue historic preservation. And so it's into the 70s as this act starts taking root quite a bit more. You have figures like Jane Jacobs, who I mentioned earlier, who really is one of the vocal individuals behind this idea of asking the community what they want, keeping in place the mixed-use urbanism that planners had been wiping away with urban renewal, and also in lobbying for preservation. So those two stories right there are really interconnected. And on the environmental front, similarly, environmentalism is having starting to have its day as well, as you have the first Earth Day celebrated. You have the National Environmental Protection Act gets passed, which says that before doing any really large-scale federally funded construction project, you need to assess what the environmental impact of that will be. So we need to think in advance about what the consequences of this are going to be, see if it's worthwhile, discuss ways of mitigating some of those damages before a project will be approved. And all of these things, on the one hand, some of them change what's going on in terms of the kinds of development practices, construction practices that are being pursued. In other ways, they just slow things down and give more time for discussion and debate before the wrecking ball or the bulldozer is set free on some of these sites. So it's a change in who's involved in the conversation, in weighing the costs, expanding our view of what the costs are of this work that really pushes back quite a bit against what the bulldozer is able to accomplish. Similarly, on the highway front, too, you have much of the interstate highway system in place, and the government starts funding a little bit more other uses of transportation dollars towards other modes of transportation besides just highways. So more expansive thinking, more citizen participation, and more recognition of the widespread costs of this approach to building and unbuilding.
Well, World War II, as you have mentioned, was crucial in being the spur, providing a sort of upgraded technological base for the demolition of the post-war period. What role did heavy earth and tree-moving equipment have in the Vietnam War, and what was the cultural reaction to such equipment in the context of such an unpopular conflict?
Yeah, I kind of bookend the book in certain ways by these two conflicts. If World War II provided an opportunity for the bulldozer to take center stage and really show what it could do and then come home and be redeployed for domestic projects, the Vietnam War was a bit of the opposite. You didn't have the same rallying around the war in the same way that you had during World War II. It was a much more divisive a conflict, but construction equipment played a different kind of role. In clearing the jungles of Vietnam, you had massive machinery, tree crushers and the kinds of things that really didn't have so much application back home, maybe to clear land for the building of a dam, but they weren't the bread and butter kinds of machines that were going to, inspire Americans at home to remake their communities or be redeployed there. So it's not that technology stopped improving during this period, but it kind of advanced to a scale and a level that wasn't as relevant for domestic applications. So you lose that kind of technological compatibility in the Vietnam War. And the war also, as I said, is not as widely embraced. And even construction workers become more contentious figures during the war as they sometimes get wrapped up in battles, on the street between protesters and construction workers and which side of the war they're on. It all just becomes much more diversely political versus the more singular way in which World War II played out, if I can simplify things a little bit. So it's not the kind of war that's going to continue to advance the prowess of this machine. And in fact, it kind of starts to get people a lot more skeptical and critical of the ways in which militarized ideas and practices are being deployed in domestic life.
Well, staying with the connection between such equipment and war and political conflict, the killing of the American activist Rachel Corrie by an Israeli bulldozer, which was made by the U.S. company Caterpillar, got great attention around the world when she was trying to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian house. How do you see the role of bulldozers today in political conflicts?
It's really, the bulldozer has become even more of an icon, I think, today, because of the way that activists have really turned it into a material enemy, standing in front of these machines as they did during urban renewal. But in the case of Rachel Corrie, as you mentioned, being killed, not by design, but falling to the hand of a bulldozer. It's much more obviously political in its valence today, as epitomized by events like this. I think also the application of bulldozers to clearing away squatters in countries around the world today, too, only adds to the kind of negative baggage that's associated with the machine. And Caterpillar, the company, of course, distances itself from some of these applications, that they are just the manufacturer and certainly not condoning or even arming these machines in certain ways that they're being deployed in some of these places around the world. But there is much more criticism of the explicit violence that's being imposed.
Well, finally, let me ask you whether what you term a culture of clearance, which is how you talk about the post-war period, spanning technology, ideology, policy, and practice, is that culture of clearance beyond us now, or does it continue with us in different ways?
What I've termed in the book at the end is that we're moving towards a culture of conservation rather than a culture of clearance, but we're not there yet. While many of the acts that I talked about from the post-war period are over, those sources of funding have dried up, and we have a more nuanced view, widely accepted nuanced views, I think, of the costs and benefits of different types of development, anti-sprawl activism, a real criticism of urban renewal kinds of approaches. The rush to demolish and the optimism embodied in that clean slate, the potential for new development, hasn't entirely gone away. We can see this in selected cities, places like Detroit, where there are many buildings being demolished. And for Detroit, this is a high point for the destruction of its built environment. And the clearance of dilapidated structures is seen by some as a positive first step forward. I see this as different from what happened during the post-war period because these are isolated locations, several of them. I mean, there are post-industrial cities throughout the country who are experiencing these kinds of problems and turning to demolition to try to eradicate them. But we see, again, the repetition of some of the things that happened in the post-war period, this rush to clear without a clear plan for what's going to come next, the psychological damages of vacant lots where nothing is happening, where people may have had some productive uses going on in some of the structures. The costs of doing this work, again, it couldn't be accomplished without some grants, and cities that are obtaining grant funding for demolition are the ones who are able to accomplish this. So to some degree, it's repetition of what we saw before, the same struggles of what do you do with all the rubble and refuse from the demolition, and the same kinds of challenges being repeated. But it's not nationwide practice today. And I think we've learned to be skeptical and critical and to stand up for people who may get in the way of the bulldozer. Many of the structures being torn down in places like Detroit are vacant structures, which is quite different from the people who are inhabiting, the homes in New Haven and many other cities that were demolished for urban renewal. So there are different challenges there. So to answer your question, it's complicated. It hasn't gone away. It's changed. But we can still see some vestiges of the culture of clearance in children's books, in the embrace of demolition as one of the keys to the revitalization of some of these cities. And I think there are still lessons to be learned.
Francesca Allman, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with the author of Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance in the Postwar Landscape. That's published by Yale University Press. She is assistant professor of city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania. You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.